to our monthly meeting. So let us all stand, please, and the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. It has something to do with the person in the White House now that's confusing everyone. as to what we're doing. All right, may we have roll call, please?
Sure. Good evening, commissioners. Present, Chair?
I am here.
Vice Chair Hurd? Excused, I understand.
Oh, she is excused, yes.
Thank you. Commissioner Castillo?
Present.
Commissioner Griggs Murphy?
Here.
Commissioner Montgomery? Here. Commissioner Griffith?
Here.
Commissioner Jung Lee?
Here.
Thank you.
Okay, next, do we have a motion to approve last month's minutes?
I'll second.
Been moved, seconded. All those in favor,
abstain, please. Abstain, not present.
Pardon?
I wasn't there, so I can't.
Oh, okay. So we're first doing all those in favor.
Right? Aye.
And then
all right.
Don't
then
jump
we
in.
Will do abstentions. We have one, okay, who was
then
not here.
You.
And opposed, we have none opposed. All right, so it carries. Old or unfinished business?
There is none.
We have none. Modifications to the agenda. I believe we will make one. We are going to advance item B to the top of the calendar, so we will do that prior to the budget. Okay?
That sounds good. And that will move the consent calendar up. I know we do have someone from the city here who's covering us for the Mid-Penn deal that's on.
Excellent. Welcome. Happy to have you. Okay, so item B, consent agenda. Do we have a motion?
I actually have a question.
Yeah.
The two contracts, the
summer youth employment.
Yeah, I'm curious about those. Those the resources aren't reserved for OHA students, right?
Those are just for OHA.
There only are slots.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, they're not slots anymore. We did our own RFP this year. We're
going
to actually talk about it in the budget presentation. We had
okay.
it planned that way.
Okay.
But Lanita did an RFP, and we've awarded a certain number of slots and to the two highest awarding entities, which mm-hmm. were Lau Family and YEP. Mm-hmm. We're not participating by doing the city agreement into the mayor's office
okay.
anymore. So we're doing our own. And there's a couple of reasons for that they agree with, so we're going to try and do our own. So it'll be for OHA kids
okay.
only. And it's a new deal, so we're going to give it a shot. We did the contract. It's a multi-year contract, but we don't have, depending on how it works out every year and whether we have money is when we'll keep doing it. So we'll renew it annually if we want to. But it's a new deal for us. We haven't paid for it directly in this way. The reasons I like it and reasons I like the mayor's program better, but the mayor's program is changing and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And last mm-hmm. year we were the largest contributor to it, and so we thought we would design something that was more focused not just on our kids, but also year-round,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
they can roll in and we can do some winter. So Lanita has phase one during the summer, but then following all of our enrollees through next year, and then if they're still of age next summer, picking up again. Because I think consistency is what we need with our youth here.
And then I have another question just mm-hmm. about the programs in terms of like eligibility and mm-hmm. whether or not there are barriers to participation, like in terms of, especially most distinctly whether or not they drug test and whether or not
that's a good question
and whether or not if they
Lanita,
support
maybe you can
for
answer because I don't
use.
Think we do that. I don't know whether the city does.
Yeah.
To be an eligible youth, I think you need to be an OHA resident and of the age.
Mm-hmm.
So we're inviting up Lanita Wheeler, our director of family and community partnerships.
Good evening. As Eric stated, I'm Lanita Wheeler, director of FCP. Currently, OHA and our programs for youth, we have not been drug testing young individuals. We've just been confirming their age. We've been confirming that they're actually residents, excuse me, on the lease and fit within whatever the program guidelines, like if it's for teens or teenagers, so on and whatnot. I am not aware of the city and our history in partnering with them, with the mayor's program. I'm not aware of them doing drug testing either.
I'm not either.
And I believe that would have been, you know, common knowledge. It would have been understood as part of the budget process. The typical barriers to youth participating tend to be transportation, which we provide support, as well as the basic soft skills, knowing how to be, you know, reliable. And we have a training program prior to them being placed that covers those. But this is the first time, and I'm almost a little embarrassed to say it, it's never even occurred to me to consider the drug testing for them.
In my experience, the city never did it because it was too chaotic. They couldn't pull that off even if they wanted to. There were too many kids, you know, and it was too rushed.
Yeah, my question is really because oftentimes there is drug testing and there isn't any support, or there isn't drug testing but there still isn't support, and so it's mostly, I was hoping that it wasn't a barrier, and then if there is information about it, that there is support, and it doesn't sound like it's a barrier.
It's not the barrier for testing, forgive me, but I do know that they require, we've required in our RFP ongoing case management services and retention, and there is dedicated case managers who are required to meet with the youth at regular intervals to check in on their academics as well as their employment, as well as general life skills, life enrichment, which I would presume in the event substance abuse was a need, that that case manager would then connect them to the appropriate services. So we do ensure that services are a significant part of the employment process for our young people.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a question. Is there a difference in scope or intensity between the two contracts with Lao Family and YP?
There are some slight differences. Lao Family is going to serve youth 16 through 24, and they will be placed in a variety of employment opportunities depending upon the employers that Lao Family and their subcontractors are able to secure. And then the YEP program is specific to adults 18 through 24, and YEP has youth social entrepreneurship programs, and they are five different tracks specifically that they would go through. So culinary is one. Forgive me, I didn't bring my notes with me, but it is part of my budget presentation. I feel like logistics is one, and there are three others that are escaping me at present. But they would go through specific industry training if the 18 through 24-year-olds, and of course they would be able to not have the limitations of being restricted to working just in the summer because they are adults.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
I'd like to move the consent agenda.
Okay, it has been moved.
I second.
Seconded. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Any opposed? Any abstentions? Carries unanimously.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Commissioners.
So now we are ready to move to item A.
Item A is our budget workshop presentation and review of the Oakland Housing Authority comprehensive budget for fiscal year ending June 30th, 2020, which I can't believe when I read
it. Yeah, that's really scary.
So we have a prepared PowerPoint that we're going to start. We have the usual memo, which does want to report to the commissioner on the commissioner's travel. So it's there now and in December, so you see it twice a year. It's all well within the budget. But we want to walk through. Different departments are going to give the presentation as soon as we get it up. But moving just to the first slide, if we click the down, I think you have it, Dominica. The first slide, that's the second, that's this third. That's it. All right, the first slide. What I wanted to do is first just kind of introduce the budget process. And I know some of it people know, but I don't know that I've actually said how it kind of the calendar this year. And I wanted to put a, I wanted to get that out there, the timeline. We usually start the budget in December, and it takes a while to draft the budget, get it rolled up. Beyond that part, at the same time, we have the annual plan. So the MTW plan that you see in review and then vote on in March is actually what is the basis for what we're funding. So they're directly related documents. And I think we don't say that aloud enough, that if you fund X number of slots for a MTW local program, then what we do is do the corresponding amount in this year's budget. If we say we're going to do X number of new programs and there's dollar amounts, then we have to incorporate it into the budget. So they're really related, and I just think it's important that, one, the world and everybody understands that the plan is, this is, the budget is an instrument that implements the plan. The other thing that I was just going to suggest that I think would be beneficial, and if I was going to still be here, I would definitely do it, is in the December meeting, we usually have a really light agenda, and I would say a budget discussion of the 2021 budget that early on is really what we need to get input and feedback, and that would impact both the plan and then the budget. And it would just be going over some of the ideas that we're kicking around that we're going to put in the plan and getting some feedback, and if you have any suggestions or ideas on how we put things together. So that's the process I kind of wanted to start with. And that, then we're going to start with Dominica, because I cannot pass up an opportunity to educate people how MTW works. So the first slides, she's really going to talk about something called substantially the same number of families as if the funds had not been combined. That's in the statute that formed MTW. So I just want to run through some of those numbers and how they're calculated, because in the future, that's going to kind of be the math you live and breathe by. Particularly if we get in tighter budget cycles than we are. So I will turn it over to Dominica Henderson, our Director of Planning, Implementation, and Compliance.
Good evening, Commissioners. I'm just going to jump right in. We have a lot of slides. There are 5 statutory requirements that all MTW agencies must meet. The requirement that has the most significant budgetary impact is the requirement to serve substantially the same number of low-income families as if the traditional funds from the Housing Choice Voucher, Public Housing, and Capital Fund programs had not been combined, similarly to when the agency operated prior to its MTW designation. For fiscal year 2020, OHA's baseline number of families that it must serve is just over 13,500 families. All the budget requests that will be discussed in this presentation were developed based on the plan to serve these families that's outlined in the fiscal year 2020 MTW annual plan.
And my only addition to the 13, those are only MTW families. They don't count Shelter Plus Care. They don't count BASH. All those are additional different contracts and not related to the MTW.
But it does include public housing, right?
Yes. No. It includes public housing, includes low-income housing tax credit families that are not otherwise assisted, and we're going to march through that.
As part of the MTW designation, OHA has the ability to use its single fund flexibility to perform a number of eligible activities that will help the authority meet its statutory requirements. Some of the examples of eligible activities are using HAP or housing assistance payments for something other than paying owners, development activities using acquisition, rehab, and new construction. We are also allowed to provide family supportive services and employment development assistance to low-income families, increase security and safety measures, preserve public housing and project-based voucher units, as well as create local non-traditional programs that provide a short-term housing assistance that's not in the form of public housing or housing choice voucher subsidy. So these are just some of the examples that are in the MTW agreement. There are several pages worth of waivers that we're allowed to use, but these are some of the examples that we do use in our MTW plan. In addition to the statutory requirements, we also have the obligation that all of our activities performed using the MTW single fund budget must meet at least one of these statutory objectives. So any of the examples that are pursued using one of the examples that I provided in the previous slide must at a minimum incentivize self-sufficiency in families with children, increase housing choice for low-income families, or reduce costs, and achieve greater cost effectiveness in using federal expenditures. So we have the statutory requirements, we have to meet all 5, and we have statutory objectives where each activity must meet at least one, and many of them meet more than one. The formula, okay, here's where it gets a little complicated. The formula that's used.
We spent about 3 years with HUD negotiating this, and then they tried to rescind it, and then they just said, okay, we're going to leave it. So it gets very complicated for a second.
So the formula that's used to calculate MTW, the number of MTW families served, is the unit month average of families served in each program over the total adjusted baseline number of families that OHA can serve based on its MTW funding. So the unit month average is the numerator, and it's the number of families served at each point in time each month. So it's a pretty straightforward number that changes month to month. But it generally doesn't change a whole lot because it's the number of families we're serving. That doesn't have large swings. The denominator is the adjusted baseline of vouchers and public housing families that can be served based on our allocation, our MTW allocation only, which is generated. This number is generated at a point in time each year and is an annualized number. It's called the adjusted baseline because it changes based on the number of vouchers and public housing units that are gained or lost during the fiscal year. As an example, in fiscal year 2016, the OHA baseline was 14,051 families. We added eight families. We added eight families due to a mod rehab conversion, which brought our MTW adjusted baseline for fiscal year 2017 to 14,059.
What you just said is every time we get a new award of vouchers, which we get whenever HUD does a conversion, we've gotten several for some mod rehabs that converted over, we'll get new vouchers. That goes into the denominator. In other words, those are families that we now have new families in the program. So our Section 8 budget and allocation went up. So they make the adjustment and are saying, okay, this year we added eight, so it went from, 1451 to 1459. So that's our new family. That's how many we're supposed to serve. So when you go to total OHA served through the programs, traditional, all the Building Bridges programs, the non-traditional programs, as well as the traditional Section 8, which is, and Section 9, which is public housing, those are voucher unit months or unit occupied months. And that comes out of the HUD business system. So they generate that for us. We don't really have any control on that. It gets provided and filled in. It's based on utilization, so how many Section 8 vouchers we have in a given month that are there. They add up each month, and that's our total. And so the figure in our reports can look a lot, because they're counting voucher unit month families, so times it by 12 is, I guess, what I'm saying. When you get to the bottom, and do you want me to jump to the bottom and the percentage? This is the percentage of families served. If you look in 2017 and 18 and 19 is sort of the recovery from our loss of landlords and lack of utilization. So we're down what looks like for us low. And for us, it is low. We were at 94%. Now we're back up to 96%. We're projecting another 96%. What I would tell you is under the guidance, and this is even under the new MTW authorities, and I know Commissioner Castillo is actually on that advisory board and even on the phone call a couple weeks ago.
I was.
And giving great comments, I would add.
Thank you.
There's something they have not issued a formal rule on, but is the accepted policy about when you hit the threshold where you have to maybe do an explanation about why you're under, and that's really 90. And we have never been that low. Mm-hmm. But there are agencies who are MTW who've been as low as, 68%.
Wow.
And they need to improve their operations, mm-hmm, and what they're doing. we're not that. We also are an agency that does very well in terms of cash flowing, and we can, I think, serve as close to 100% as any MTW agency in the traditional voucher program and still have enough residual money, MTW dollars, to cover what we cover it with, which is some of our central office cost center, all of our family and community partnerships, and all of our police department. So it's every year going to be a balancing act, and if some of that cash flows differently because we had to go to 110% voucher payment standards, so we may lose 10% of HAP over time, because the rents are going to be higher. We had to go up because of the fair market rents, then you're going to have less HAP money, and that's where it becomes really important to make sure you can serve within the amount and still do the initiatives that we need to do. And that's where HUD gets into a normal kind of MTW agency just entering the program. They're looking at a 90%. So you could use 10% of your voucher money to do MTW initiatives, employment, as well as development and other activities. So we're not where I would like to be. I would like to be like 2 or 3% higher than 96 for our projected this year. But this is what we think we can pull off. Right.
Would you like questions during or after? It's up to you.
It's up to you. Mm-hmm.
We have questions at the end of all of them, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Two things I wanted to add. Just one, that the when we were at 94% in fiscal year 2017, HUD requested that we describe the plan that we have in place for achieving higher than 94%. So we did submit a plan that says that we will, you know, in addition to the project-based voucher commitments that we've made, we also have significant investment in the landlord incentives, trying to lease up and have greater utilization in the Housing Choice Voucher Program. So we do have a plan that we have outlined in our MTW annual plan as a response to the dip to 94%. Another thing I wanted to mention is that the numbers that we use for fiscal year 2019 are a projection because we use the monthly reports. We don't have, we obviously haven't completed the fiscal year 2019, so I just want to make sure that you understand that this number may change when we come to you in the future to let you know what the actual baseline was for 2019.
These are projections.
Yeah. In preparation for the presentations that'll follow this mine, the next two slides will discuss the planned number of families that will be served in fiscal year 2020. This strategy is detailed in the fiscal year 2020 MTW annual plan draft that was brought to you last month for submission approval. We expect to serve about 13,793 families through the public housing voucher and local non-traditional programs. So public housing and vouchers, the vouchers includes both the tenant-based program and the project-based voucher program. And public housing and the voucher program are what we call traditional. And then we have the local non-traditional programs, which are just the OHA-specific activities. Unlike the past 3 years, we do expect that the adjusted baseline will change based on an addition of 92 vouchers as the result of a mod rehab conversion. And we also plan to reduce the public housing inventory by 560 units as a result of RAD at the mixed finance sites and disposition at the senior site at most of the senior site portfolio. These 560 families will increase on the voucher side. So there's no net loss of family served. However, as part of the way HUD calculates its baseline, the addition of the vouchers must wait at least 1 year before being added to the MTW allocation. So we will reduce in 2020 560, but we'll add them back in 2021 and on the voucher side.
And this changed a little bit from the original disposition in 2010. So we took 1,600 units basically from public housing to Section 8. At that time, we dropped then way below because they were counting them from day one. So HUD realized that was a problem. We did a little thing. They said, yes. We said, won't you change the baseline so we can keep being glorious at 98, 99, 100? They said, no, it's in there. You can understand it. But they've since changed the rule a little bit and the way they implement it so we won't get hit that way. And that's what she just explained. They'll remove the public housing and then the following year add in the new vouchers. So we get a little break for a year, you know, in terms of the unit count.
So it's actually a break. It's not a penalty.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Before it was a penalty because on April 10th of 2010, we flipped 1,600 units they removed 1,600 units from public housing. And then they awarded us 1,600 new vouchers, and it took us 6 months to get all the eligibility and paperwork into HUD to count. So we lost a series, you know, of months of serve. So it looked like we were really under lease when we weren't. We were still serving the family. They were still housed. They weren't in the PIC system until the end of the year. So they fixed that.
What is the reason for that 1 year disconnect? Because you're actually looking at inaccurate numbers.
They are, but the only way you get these vouchers is through a Section 8 disposition that had HUD's approval. And they come to you as tenant protection vouchers. So what they use is the fact that they're tenant protection vouchers for the first year, and then they roll into your MTW baseline. They use that to say this is how we're going to now interpret it. But they didn't do that in 2010.
Right. It's a rule that came into existence in 2013.
13.
And we have the choice of whether or not we want to move them into our MTW allocation. So we could keep them as tenant protection vouchers separate from our MTW allocation, but we generally choose to, or have in the past, up until now, chosen to add them to our MTW voucher pot. So.
And keep in mind, this case, we're project basing those from the word go. So they're going right to the property and project basing. You know, it's a direct flip. So we're not going to go through. Section 18 dispositions can actually, you can apply for them to tear down housing. And instead, you get vouchers, and they don't have to live. They go find a place in the open market.
Right, but people are staying.
Yeah.
In the same property, so that's why.
And we're project basing them right onto the site from day one, and then and yeah. And they're all new vouchers. Awesome. Yeah. All right.
Okay. So, based on all of the adjustments, the increases and decreases in the adjustment in the adjusted baseline. The families that we plan to serve through our 27 MTW activities using our single fund flexibility, OHA proposes that it'll serve about 101% of its baseline during fiscal year 2020. This number is slightly inflated because the vouchers, as I mentioned before, for the public housing units will be added back in 2021. So right now it's 560 fewer in our capacity that will be added back in 2021. But the next slides that my colleagues will present will demonstrate just how OHA intends to use its MTW single fund to serve all 13,793 or more, hopefully, families for fiscal year 2020.
And the one thing I would add about the baseline and the change of the 101% is that during the Section 18 disposition, it also includes a RAD disposition. So we're going to move the mixed finance sites, the ones that are already in developments, are going to transition from public housing onto RAD. And Dave's been working on that. He's estimating we'll get the application in sometime in September, maybe October. It then goes into the HUD pipeline. We don't know when we'll get those vouchers. So what Dominica's doing is just projecting to get an estimate for the year. When the timing of all this could change is, I guess, what I'm saying. In terms of the senior site disposition, we'll put that through this summer for the Oak Groves and then next year for Harrison above us. So there'll be 100 more units at Harrison. So it's not all going to happen at once. And how that plans out in the math of this is, you know, we'll see, because it depends on HUD's approval and our timeline. What she's doing is just projecting it as an estimate for the year. So these are just estimates, so you can understand how that substantially the same number of families really works every year. And I think it should be part of what we talk about as the budget is how we're going to meet that goal and how we're going to get as close to 100% as we can.
So I'm available for questions.
I think that we have been at 13,500 families for a while, right? So we're in preserve protect mode for a very long time. And I realize that there's a lot of variables, you know, in that situation, yet the need around us continues to grow. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's not on us. I just want to be clear that if HUD would give us more voucher money, we would be able to serve more families. Is that?
That's absolutely right.
So that's because we're just preserving the number of families that we have when the need out there is so great. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of like what I took away from this right now, because I've been here for 5 years and I think we've been at that $13,000 mark. And do you understand around us, it's mm-hmm. like.
And where we have grown is in the local non-traditional category.
Absolutely.
You can see that we've jumped significantly over the past 3 or 4 fiscal years. And so where we are, unable or having challenges in the voucher program and the traditional side, we still are serving families through our local non-traditional programs and growing those programs. So that combined with increased utilization will really have a broader reach across the number of families we can serve.
And to our credit, to be able to stay where we are and protect and preserve our families at these numbers during a serious rental crisis is also, you know, we need to be applauded for that.
And to your point, we live in a neighborhood where everybody is in shortfall except for us and not serving 100%.
Yeah.
So they've gone down. They're serving fewer families than they ever have.
So wouldn't it be incredible if we were to set a 5-year goal to somehow serve X number of families mm-hmm. more? You know,
We don't really do that. We just kind of like, let's try to.
Yeah, let's try this and this. And
yeah.
Partially, just how do you project the funding in a 5-year is my challenge with that. Do we say, okay, we're going to get the same number of vouchers? And
no, it's like, you know, who's going to be president?
Yeah, I know. And which way is inflation going to go? That's the other challenge. Yeah.
Thank you.
Question, isn't it true that, this is a question, isn't it true that we are actually serving more families due to the joint ventures that we have done?
Yeah, very much. And we're serving a bunch of.
So, in other words, we've added to the overall housing stock by these ventures that we have done, these development.
Yeah, and we didn't do the long term, but when we didn't do the long term of where we were and where we are, which would tell a different picture. But the other thing is, this doesn't include, you know, some other contracts in Shelter Plus Care, but it does include some of the people who are receiving a shallow subsidy, the emancipated foster youth.
Okay.
So we're serving them for less. It includes low-income housing tax credit only families that we get credit for, which is why we can go up to, you know, the voucher lease, because we get credit for those. And, you know, overall, we serve anywhere from 16,500 if you count everything. And it kind of depends on how you count. And I know that sounds weird, but how do you count OPI? Do you count them on the project-based side, or do you count them on the public housing or the management side, or both? So, it, you know, some of that is in the details of it. But we are increasing the number of families that we serve. What I like to think, though, is we're actually changing the way we serve some of the families. So when it says expanding housing choice, the first read of that, people will say, oh, so you're building new units in other neighborhoods or something. That's only one way to expand choice. Sure. Expanding choice is making sure you have a process for people who couldn't normally access Section 8 or Section 9 programs successfully to get into assisted housing. That's expanding dramatically the choice for that family or that individual. And that's a big chunk of our building bridges.
Absolutely.
Is serving people different. 260 people in SROs. You know, it's a big chunk, and with services-enriched housing. So they don't walk in there without having lifelong medical or someone helping the family and helping them stabilize.
Can MTW funds be used to provide for new units for families from 60 to 80%? I'm referring to your comments in the article.
Yes, it's exactly. So, no. So here's this, and it is, you know, low-income housing tax credit program goes up to 60% AMI.
Right.
They usually do targeting levels. They'll do X number of 20, 30, 40, sometimes 50, but it can't be more than 60. The public housing program, ironically, can go up to 80% AMI, and the MTW program can as well. So the MTW program can go up to 80%, but the tax credit bonds can only go up to 60. So in the case of OPI, when we wrote that application, we actually said we were going to keep OPI units below 60% because we knew that was the tax credit threshold. We could have gone with 80 and HUD would have approved it, but we wanted to make sure they were preserved lower, and particularly at that time. Now the question is, how do you get from 60, which is tax credit, and to your point, and I think it was in the article, to 120%, which are displaced families. And that's a niche that is really hard to reach. The 60 to 80 MTW can do. How you get above 80 is you get into non-federal funds and different operating entities.
So I'm sorry, I'm going off topic here, but I read an article recently about the kind of fees that cities charge for accessory dwelling units.
Mm-hmm.
And I was astounded at the cost. I think it's $75,000 for San Jose per unit.
Who's going to
build that? So I'm just wondering, so I think the state legislature is looking at how those rates can come down, but maybe there is an avenue. I'm blue skying here with private financing to helping more units happen to serve, you know, all families up to 80%, as long as we can increase the housing stock.
Well, one of the things we talked actually to Nancy Skinner's office a year and a half ago about, and it almost made it introduced, but it hasn't, but I pitched the language to several entities around the Bay, and I'm relentless with it because it's all drafted and ready to go as a pilot that was for Alameda and Contra Costa, but it could be the 9-county Bay Area. It could include other counties. in the Health and Safety Code of the State of California, which governs housing authorities, created them in 1938 and still governs them. It's been amended and amended, and honestly, I think it reads like one of the great train wrecks of legislation because it's been amended and changed so time. You can't figure out what you can and can't do very easily. So first I approached her about trying to clean it up. That's a really heavy lift. And so then she came back and said, why don't we just do a pilot program, which I thought was ingenious, so we have it drafted. We're precluded in the Health and Safety Code from buying market rate property. It occurred in the 30s because when the state was funding, was creating housing authorities, including this one, the third one in the state, and LA County the first, San Francisco the second, and us the third, it was that the private developer community at the time was doing massive construction in San Fernando Valley and other areas. You know, it was the 30s and 40s and then into the 50s. And the private market rate folks were not going to support creation of housing authorities unless, because they thought we'd have an unfair advantage. Mm-hmm. So they wrote this into California's law, and it doesn't exist in other states, into California's law that precludes us. And I think it's time for it to go. I think it's just past due. If you really wanted to help gentrification, and this agency could do what King County has done, which is get a $100 million line of credit, buy properties that are for sale, and then have them privately managed, but then set the rent levels based on the expense of the property rather than maximizing the income of the property. Right. And they're doing that right and left, and their interest went up, and their ED told me a week or two ago that they're right now not doing deals. They're waiting for the interest to drop again. But that's what I think. That's the way we would facilitate it. And if you know, Ebalsi really has the fund and has tried to do that. They've had some problems with it and scale. And just the size of the properties that are available in Oakland. But if you deal with an agency that is as strong as we are and with the access to capital that we could have,
yeah,
it really could change the picture. And I don't think we're alone. I think Santa Clara could change the picture as well. You know, they're MTW and they're large as well and could have a dent. And that's where I think the regional approach and getting a regional waiver so that we can actually try and do this could really help us get to 100%, 90%, or even 110% AMI.
Yeah. That would be great. Okay.
All right. I think we're moving on.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Why don't you click that forward so we know who's next, people we don't remember. Dave Cadu, Real Estate Development is next up. Perfect timing.
I wonder if we should just even track those as a memo or in the budget.
We can. We could actually, and we could actually track them.
Keep track of that so that we can feel good about what we're doing.
One of the things we started in the monthly report that Michelle does for leased housing is actually tracking all the project-based Section 8 awards and where we are on that. And we could actually add the low-income housing tax credit to that table pretty easily. It doesn't change that much. So you know how many new families we're serving.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we are doing good things, and it's not always coming through.
And the report itself, I know, see, I love the monthly report because it makes me read everything before I put it together for you guys. But I also use it through the month often. Sometimes I'll go back and add totals up. People have a question. It's amazing how many questions we answer in that monthly report. So people ask you a question about us, flip through the last board packet monthly report because it's probably in there.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Dave Cadu, Senior Director of Real Estate Development. About to go through a fairly long and dense presentation, so would encourage you all to ask questions as they come up, lest we all forget by the time I am done. So we've been busy over the last year. We've been diligently developing a pipeline, doing a lot of work to get ourselves in a position where we're ramping up and doing more development activity than we have in years past. And as a result of that, we're finally at a place where I feel like we need to start increasing the capacity of our department. So as such, you can see that we've got a request in for an additional position for this department that would bring us to 4 senior program manager positions and a total headcount of 7, combined with the 7 folks that work currently in asset management. That would bring a total of 14 working on real estate development related activities. As background and a little more information on why we're making this request, I'd like to walk you through kind of the context of our goals, our challenges, and our assets before going through our individual activities. So in terms of the development goals, the overarching principle we're working with here is, in conjunction with the authority's development policy, we want to expand the affordable housing stock in Oakland to slow displacement, reduce housing insecurity, and eliminate homelessness in the shortest possible time. It's not a small goal, but it's also not a small problem, and we're diligently working to do everything we can to get there. So I've set an informal target for our department for the 10-year period ending 2028 of producing 1,200 new units and preserving over the long term 600 more. To do so, we would like to leverage our existing assets to minimize both the use of local and state soft funds that are competitive, as well as our own MTW dollars as gap funding for the deals we work on ourselves. Would also like to leverage our PBVs and HCVs to the greatest extent possible to stretch that scarce resource as far as we can. As we'll touch on a little later, we're 60,000 units short, and we got about 1,500 project-based vouchers left to play with. So as you imagine, each and every one counts dramatically.
Yeah, Dave, I'm just curious. When you're talking about leveraging existing assets, are you referring to leverage
him
with debt?
Yes, in some cases, absolutely. So, we'll go over the details a little bit later on, but, we own approximately $1 billion worth of real estate free and clear. A 2010 disposition was probably the best thing this agency ever did, frankly, and it's left us in a position where we've got assets that we can turn into more housing if we choose to do so. And so that's the big focus of what we're doing here.
Oh, I see what you mean. So by leveraging, you mean we're taking like a sixplex and turning it into a 10 or 12.
That's right. Yeah, I would not suggest that we're not simply extracting equity from our existing assets, but we're using it to build additional ones.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. And finally, we're looking to increase density on sites we already have in our portfolio at the same time assist other developers to get forward and move forward with their developments on sites we do not own. So as a bit of context, this is all old news to everybody in this room, I think, but this has long been one of the most expensive housing markets in the country, and the recent boom has done us absolutely no favors in that regard. As of 2007, and I think things have gotten steadily worse since then, but as of 2017, average rent within the county for a two-bedroom unit is $2,593. We have a vacancy rate of approximately 1% and a deficit of 60,000 units of affordable housing. We've got approximately 6,000 homeless individuals sleeping on the streets any given night countywide, half of whom are in Oakland. The cost of development has gone through the roof, not only because of local factors, but also global factors such as the cost of materials, the tariffs that we are hearing so much about in today's news, so on and so forth. Our costs are now typically in excess of $700,000 a unit. And costs and land use issues have led to a real slowdown in the development here in the Bay Area, where we've added only 4 units of housing for every 10 jobs that have been added over the last decade. If you add that up, that is close to 1 million units that we're short statewide. So it's not very promising. I think the average size is probably going to be a 2-bedroom.
Chair, could I remind you to use your mic, please, so we get this on the recording.
Square feet.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. It's probably around 1,000. If I'm guessing, it's a little shade over a typical 2-bedroom. About 1,000 square feet. Yep. So in spite of all those challenges, we do have a number of things in our favor. As noted before, we've got 1,600 units through our 2010 scattered site disposition. We own those free and clear. They're 100% covered with Section 8, and if I had to put a price tag on them, it would be worth about $1 billion in the open market. So very, very good decision to dispose those about a decade ago. We've got another 253 units of public housing with related to our senior site disposition that will be coming out of public housing over the next couple of years. We've got a stake in over 1,900 units of mixed financed or tax credit housing with the sole ownership of 222 of those units. And we own several parcels that are owned free and clear that we could use for development if we chose to. And we have a very substantial financial capacity among the authority and its affiliates and instrumentalities that can support private financing and allow us to do a lot more work than those dollars alone could accomplish. In terms of strategies, we want to redevelop our existing sites to increase density and increase the number of families we can serve on the properties we already own. We can pursue partnerships with private developers to participate in deals, which is something that we have been doing for quite some time now. And we can simply choose to preserve our existing properties where possible. So the first of those strategies is to redevelop our current assets at a higher density. As noted before, in various forms, we own about 2,000 units of housing free and clear, including our most recent Section 18 demo dispo approvals. We can leverage the value of the property to build additional units. And so there are a number of different ways we can start to work on this. We can combine multiple smaller sites to form transactions that are attractive to lenders and investors in the open market. They might not be interested in us building a 20-unit building, but if we put five of them together, they would be interested in a 70-unit complex with five scattered sites. We can identify sites with potential for high-density housing as candidates for teardown and redevelopment. We do have some larger lots within the OP portfolio that could support much larger buildings. We have some buildings that are two stories within a neighborhood context that could support three or four, and we want to make sure that we squeeze every last unit out of that portfolio that we possibly can. And finally, we can utilize a shallow subsidy on some units to provide housing security without expending the full value of a voucher. So within the OP portfolio, you know, we've got a lot of 100% Section 8 properties. You don't necessarily need 100% Section 8 to make a deal go financially. However, there are families that would certainly benefit from having, you know, the protection of only paying 30% of their income every month, even if the property doesn't need the money from the Section 8 vouchers. So we can stretch our dollars a little further and provide security for folks and prevent them from falling into homelessness by providing shallower subsidies in some cases. So, you know, I've touched on the OP redevelopment before here. I think we're still targeting approximately 500 additional units within that scattered site portfolio, and we still believe we can do that at a relatively minimal cost to the agency. So one thing that has to happen before we do is we need to get land use approvals from the city. We are currently pursuing a citywide overlay zone that would allow 100% affordable housing to skip the CEQA and part of the land use entitlement process entirely. It would be a great move that would add tremendous value to the OP portfolio, but would also assist other developers developing affordable housing citywide. Feel like there's a pretty good amount of political support for it right now. We're going to try to strike while the iron's hot. Everybody's talking about housing, and we're hopeful we can get that through, and that will pave the way for us to move quite quickly through through this portfolio. We'd also augment teardowns with rehab of smaller sites to generate additional tax credit equity through acquisition basis. And this goes back to the notion of bundling groups of properties, groups of five properties together. In the tax credit program, you get tax credit equity off of the value of a building that you acquire and rehabilitate, but you do not get the value of land. So if we simply tore down a building, had a blank piece of land, and tried to build on it, we would not get any tax credit equity at all. But if we combine one teardown with four buildings that we rehab, we get to take the value of those four buildings and earn equity on it that can be put forward towards the new construction. So basically, you know, we would expect to get about $150,000 of equity out of every unit of housing in this portfolio through the tax credit program if we did a normal 4% acquisition rehab deal. If we only do $75,000 or $100,000 worth of work on that unit and get $150,000 of equity, that leaves us with $75,000 that we can put towards the new construction and reduce the gap for the units that we're actually building and adding to the portfolio. And finally, we're looking to be pretty aggressive in utilizing new methods of construction to lower our costs. We're planning on pilot testing some of the new modular construction methods that are out there right now. It's going to do two things for us. Number one, it's probably going to reduce our costs because we're not building on site, but it will also dramatically compress our time frame for development. It might knock 6 months off of our construction. In a typical deal, if we're paying $200,000 a month in construction loan interest, that adds up quite quickly and helps our bottom line. So I think I've walked you through this before, but this is kind of an example of what we're talking about within a redevelopment project through OPI. So you'll see on that map there is one building that is outlined in pink. That would be the largest of those five sites. It's currently a 14-unit building. We feel like we can get 36 units on to that parcel within the neighborhood context and within what would be kind of a reasonable intensification of development there. The other four blue squares would simply be rehabilitated, again, partially to improve the quality of that stock, but also to bring in additional tax credit equity to do the new construction deal.
You would have tax credit equity then coming in from the rehab sites that would be in excess of what you would need to actually rehab the site.
That's the hope, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean,
I hesitate to use the word profitable, but that leverageable, I guess.
Well, you know, in this case it is, and it really revolves around the fact that we've got 100% Section 8 coverage on these buildings, which would lead to a very, very high appraised value. So in the case of the Oak Groves, it's 152 one-bedroom units. Even though it's income-restricted, we've got a Section 8 contract that's being laid on it prospectively as part of the Section 18 disposition.
Yeah,
that property appraised at $50 million. So, you know, that's for a one-bedroom unit, that's $300,000+ in actual value. We take about 40% of that as acquisition credits on that, and that's the amount of equity that comes in.
I see.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So these are all much larger units than that. So our Section 8 contract value is much higher and actually is probably going to appraise out at even higher than $300,000+ a unit. So, you know, under this proposal, we would add 22 units to the project. And this is, it's a single partnership, would own all five buildings at once. So we'd consider the five buildings to be a single project, which would bring us from 36 existing units to 58 total units. It would also have the benefit of having 36 of these units now be new construction rather than our old OP portfolio. Buildings which were constructed in the 60s and 70s for the most part and are facing pretty considerable capital needs.
I see. So this would be taking a group of OP structures,
Correct.
Current structures, right? And then we would put those into a new partnership that would be another subset of OP.
That's
or
correct.
Something.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And Dave, this also includes the new units, tearing down the 14 building more, but also when we do rehab those other four sites, there will be cases where we'll split units?
Yeah, correct. We could certainly look at doing that. You know, right now we've got a disconnect between the number of large units that we have in the OP portfolio and the
right.
number of families seeking large units. It's especially true of our four-bedroom units, for instance, where we simply can't get people on the wait list fast enough to
right.
fill those up sometimes. So we could take those, we could whittle them down into a couple of
right.
One or two bedroom units and have a better matchup between our wait list and our actual portfolio.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm sorry, but I don't understand the second set of numbers. Those are different from the first set of numbers. Is that right?
Well, it's the same 58 units. And this is just showing which of those units are new construction and which are rehabbed. So it's a little confusing because we started with 36 units and we built a new 36 unit building. So I'm sure that is not the best example to throw
okay.
out there. But
okay.
Basically, we're tearing down 14 units and adding 36 new construction. The remaining 22 units would be rehabbed. And, you know, within that, we could probably, if we choose to do so and we choose to serve, you know, a formerly homeless population, we could probably shoehorn 12 supportive housing units into this concept pretty comfortably without building a supportive housing project.
And that's where we do need more density from the city to do that in many
Absolutely.
Cases.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sorry, did that answer the question? Or?
I think so.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Sure. So in terms of the financing details here, you can see we've got sources and uses, and on paper, this is approximately a $45 million project. Looking at the left-hand column, which includes the sources, if you look at the third and fourth of those, which are marked to seller carryback and the deferred developer fee, those are actually only on paper. Those aren't actual cash requirements. So the seller carryback note represents the appraised value of the properties that gets basically lent back to the project. So you're actually getting the building for free, but on paper you book a $13 million purchase price so that you can claim tax credit equity on that. Deferred fee is the same way. You're allowed to take 15% of the project expenses as fee. But in this case, since we're paying our own gap, it doesn't necessarily make sense to take that all in cash. So that $4.1 million of deferred developer fee is booked on paper but not actually paid out as a project expense. What that means is this project is reduced down to about a $27 million project when you consider only the cash requirements. And about half of that is going to be paid for by tax credit equity. We can leverage some actual permanent debt on a first mortgage to take out the rest, but we're projecting an MTW gap loan of approximately $4.3 million that would be required to produce these units. There's kind of another asterisk to that, which is, you know, we're doing $4.3 million of gap financing to make this go, but we're performing $2 million of rehab on buildings that would otherwise come out of the OP coffers. So if you back out the fact that we're getting that benefit as well that might otherwise come out of our budget, that reduces our gap down to about $2.3 million. Recall that we're taking $1 million in developer fees, so the actual net cost is only about $1.3 million. And at 2.3, that means we're adding units for about $151,000 each. Or if you want to look at the value of the building that we're doing new construction on, that 36-unit building, it's down to about $92,000 each. So compared to our typical gap financing for a 4% deal, that's a serious bargain.
That's mega incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll hope that it pencils out that way once we start looking.
Those are the numbers, the likes of which we've never even glimpsed anything close to in years, right? I mean, we're looking at these astronomical costs per unit.
Yes, absolutely.
So I appreciate you're doing something very creative here, creating manna from heaven.
It's a wonderful idea, and I've never heard it, and I think it's really a credit to Dave. The other thing that it allows, you know, we have in our MTW plan that we don't have to have contiguous sites to award project-based vouchers, and that's something that makes this work, because we can do one group. What's interesting to me is it's all something that could make it work for other developers in town, because it's unique to Oakland that we can do that one authority. So someone else, a nonprofit developer, could try and do this same thing of leveraging equity for the rehab while they're doing new construction. Nice. And right now we're dividing this whole world, and we were just talking about it today in something. This whole world's divided into preservation and new construction. You know, and this is a way to bridge that absolutely. I think is really interesting.
Yeah, no, that is very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
this
we've
is
got
an A+ for creativity here.
Thank you, I appreciate that. Well, you know, we've got what you might call a 12-figure problem, you know, in Oakland with respect to being short of affordable housing. And when you have a gap that big, you need to be creative to fill it. So I'll do everything we can to chip away where we can. The second strategy, it's one that we're familiar with and we've used to great effect as an agency over the past few years. On an opportunity-by-opportunity basis, we've been able to partner with private, nonprofit, and for-profit developers to expand affordable housing in Oakland. And so, you know, this really started back in the Hope 6 era in the last couple of decades, and over that time we've partnered with partnered on about 1,700 units of mixed finance or tax credit housing. Our participation has ranged from coming to the table with the land in cases like what is now Lion Creek Crossing, where it was a formal public housing development that we redeveloped as tax credit housing with partnerships, or something more like Ave Visto, which came off a couple of years ago. It just needed a little tiny push to get over the finish line. I use tiny figuratively, but a relatively small push to get over the finish line. We provided the funding to allow them to move forward. So that participation comes at a price, and generally speaking, we obtain fee title to the land and the option to acquire the property at the end of the tax credit compliance period. Those details vary deal by deal. So in cases where we provide more, we demand more. In cases where we provide less, we demand less. But that's the general concept. And this, you know, allows us to access competitive funds that we ordinarily wouldn't if we choose to partner on property that we already own. So right now we're not in a position to go after state funding or 9% credits. If we partner with an experienced developer, we can access those funds and move forward. So among the deals we have is Brooklyn Basin. This is the entire development, not just ours, and in fact, this development will likely not look like this when the dust settles, but it's the pretty rendering that they gave us. Our properties are to the top right of the area there below the freeway. We've got 465 of the roughly 3,100 units that are proposed for that area. The whole development will be done close to the end of the next decade. It's going to take them a while to get out of the ground, but our portion will be done in 2023. So we're getting out in front of everybody. I think it's a good thing for everybody involved. And we're already underway there. If you drive down 880 and look off to your right, you can see the big hole in the ground. So it will quickly become a building.
And the building is actually the market rate one that went in first. It's not the affordable, the one that's...
That's right, yeah. Yeah, the one that's going up is the market rate.
We're hole in the ground next door.
That's right, yeah. It's actually not just a hole in the ground anymore. We've got rebar and concrete sticking out of it now. So it's moving around, it's moving along quite quickly.
Remind me how many total units that is against
us? We've got 465 between the four phases.
And
so
the whole project is?
The whole project is slated to be 3,100 right now. You know, that's over the better part of a decade. Things can change, but right now that's what their approvals are for. So this is a rendering of the actual first building that we are putting up. It will not look like a hole in the ground for much longer. Also this year we have closed on the Empyrean Towers. It's part of a rehabilitation of two SROs, the Empyrean and the Harrison, about two blocks that way. They're underway on renovation right now. We have not disbursed all of our funding, but we've participated in the Empyrean, which will preserve 65 units. And those are 65 units for the most vulnerable population we have in the city. So it's a great project with a lot of public purpose. And this, I hope you will recognize as a before picture and not an after picture. Cahi currently owns 2530 9th Avenue. We are trying to partner with a couple of local developers to rehabilitate and bring this project back online. It's a relatively small deal in our world, but one that I think the neighborhood would appreciate us moving forward with, and one that hopefully we can get through a little, you know, somewhat painlessly and at a relatively low price tag. We've got a few others. I don't have great pictures to show you, so next year this time we'll have a lot more afters for you. The third and final strategy we have is preservation of our existing assets. So in cases where we don't want to or should not tear down and redevelop existing housing, but we are eligible to place private financing on a deal, we can use closing a syndication or a refinance as a means of preserving the property and extending its useful life. Generally speaking, we're only going to do this on fairly straightforward projects. That's to preserve our own development capacity here in a house, as well as to, you know, kind of maximize the use of those funds. We're currently using the low-income housing tax credit as a fairly powerful tool at the Oak Groves, and for deals that have substantial value in the buildings, so project-based Section 8 buildings, you know, and where we own it free and clear, that can be used as a tool to do a lot of work for very little of our own money. So the Oak Groves is the first one of these that is moving forward here in our latest batch. We've got 152 units of senior housing. It's currently public housing on two separate sites that are being bundled into a single transaction. The rehab scope is substantial. The building is approaching 40 years old, and we're going to be able to do approximately $50 million worth of work at that site without using any of our own money, which is great news. A lot of that is related to the large amount of acquisition basis that we're pulling from the value of the property. That's going to get us about $20 million in tax credit equity alone, not including the equity that we're going to get off of the work that we perform there as well. That's allowed us in turn to limit the amount of permanent debt we're going to put on the property. We're only going to take out about a $19 million loan that has a term of 20 years. Typically, you would see a 30 or 35-year mortgage. So just for the sake of preserving the asset and, you know, recognizing that it may be difficult to refinance a 60-year-old building when the time comes, we feel really good about not having a huge balloon payment hanging over our heads. So we're really happy we've been able to do that. Construction should start here in about 6 to 8 weeks and should be complete by the end of the next calendar year.
Cool.
So again, no after pictures, but to show you what a 40-year-old public housing project looks like. We're going to do a substantial scope of work on the interiors, including, you know, basically doing everything in terms of the fixtures and appliances within each individual unit. And we're also going to do some a little bit of work on the common area to bring it more into a modern context.
So you're going to basically gut them and replace the...
Yeah, not down to the studs, but we're expecting
but I mean all
new
of
cabinets,
the,
new appliances, new carpet.
Yeah, it's like where there was a kitchen will just be walls, and then you'll replace the cabinetry. And
that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're also going to have to do a little exterior work. It's not only going to be work on the envelope to make sure that there's no water intrusion issues, which is our kind of number one enemy with an older building, but we're also fixing some structural issues that we're having at the balconies. It's nothing that's imminently dangerous, but you know, could become that way if we choose not to address it. So we've got the money to do some replacement of the structure on the outside and do some waterproofing that will preserve the building over the long term. So that brings us to our request for our capital outlay, and we've listed here not only capital outlays that we have requested in the current agency budget, but I've also listed those requests we're making with OPI and CAHI on these slides. With respect to the agency budget for MTW dollars, as noted, we've closed the Empyrean deal. There's a balance remaining, approximately $3.1 million on that loan that we will disperse this fiscal year. For Foothill Family, we are budgeting $5 million to supplement what we might be able to get out of a tax credit transaction to rehabilitate that property. It's been we've acquired the ownership interest from the limited partner on that deal, and we now own 100% of it, or our affiliate owns 100% of it. It is definitely time to do a little work out there, so we're going to move forward on that. For 15th and Harrison, that could be a very large project, as you've seen all the neighboring work going up in sort of a tower concept. I think we want to preserve that option for ourselves as well. This has typically been a kind of a hub for low-income residents of Oakland for a very long time. It's changing rapidly with the construction around here, so we feel pretty strongly that we need to make a big statement in this particular neighborhood. We've got a piece of land over there that we own free and clear right in the middle of all this chaos, and we would love to do something big. So we've earmarked $16 million for potential work there.
I see.
We have one remaining investor buyout on the table right now that we have not yet executed. We've budgeted $3 million there just in case. We're hopeful we will get out for less, but it's prudent to budget for the worst-case scenario, given who our investor is and the challenges that are
involved.
Some
of those
there
may be legal costs associated with the buyout.
I suspect that will be the case, yes. And then we've got a $10 million line item for acquisitions. This would either be vacant land or, if the opportunity arises, completed buildings that we would acquire and bring into our portfolio. That brings our total for the Housing Authority funded portion of the budget to a little over $37 million. In terms of what OPI is funding or what we're requesting in the OPI budget, we've got $7 million earmarked for the first two of the OPI redevelopment projects. We have taken those two to the planning department for an initial review. We don't have anything yet, but we have the land use approval already in hand for those, and we'll not have to wait for our overlay zone to be passed. So it'll allow us to get a rolling start on the OPI redevelopment, test out our modular building concept, our management concepts, and all those things. And so we budgeted $7 million in gap financing for that. For Harrison Tower, we've budgeted $1 million in pre-development expenditures for this year. We believe that the Harrison Tower budget will wind up looking a lot like the Oak Groves budget, and that we will not need to actually pay for anything when the dust settles. But in order to get us to a closing and to get our private financing to the deal, we'll need to spend some money up front, and so that's $1 million for that purpose in this line. And again, we've budgeted for some acquisitions, roughly $5 million, bringing our total request to $13 million.
And actually, this is for the chair. This is something you'd talked to me about in the past, is if we have OP properties and we have adjoining properties that become available that OP could acquire,
now I get it.
We can expand the footprint.
That was
and
my question.
Density
cool.
is the
okay.
idea.
Okay, good. Yeah. All right.
Thank you. Okay, and finally, CAHI does have a couple of lines in here. They are relatively small, but one is for that 9th Avenue rehabilitation project that we noted before. We have $118,000 in there for pre-development expenses. And we've also got $185,000 to do some environmental evaluation at 1236 East 17th. That is currently a vacant lot, but one that has some hazmat issues if we were to move forward with the development that will need to be mitigated. Brings us to $303,000 for CAHI and a grand total between those three bodies of $50,464,429.
Which is a substantially large investment, and we like to, you know, in the budget workshop, we like to talk about all our three main entities, CAHI, OP, and OHA as one. And when it does come back to the board, we only approve the OHA at this board, but I like to have the board aware of the bigger picture, because I think they're also interrelated now. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm wondering if it would be helpful here. I was just thinking, you know, because I kind of compartmentalize things in my brain, that, you know, how many units, like, so we invest $50 million, how many units do we save? How many units do we create?
Mm-hmm. I don't have the answer.
I mean, that's okay. We don't, that would just be an interesting,
sure.
That would be an interesting add-on to this, because that would, because, you know, preserving is important. If you don't preserve them, you're going to lose them.
Mm-hmm.
But just the scale of the impact that we're really having on the city here, I think might be of use.
Sure, absolutely. And I, you know, the devil's always in the details, right? Not every dollar is created equal when it comes to providing gap funding. So, you know, the dollars we're spending on the OP redevelopment, we're going to be able to stretch those a lot further because we're using that in concert with property that we own free and clear and that's worth quite a bit of money and can be leveraged to provide value. In the case of 15th and Harrison, we don't have any value in that property. We've just got a parking lot. So the per unit gap cost is going to be much higher there. But we can certainly evaluate these individual requests and let you know.
Well, you know, actually, the other component of this that I think is interesting that came out, which is kind of the clever approach to all of this, is the amount of leverage that we're actually achieving with that money.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because that money, doing this a different way, you would not be able to do this for $50 million, right?
Right.
I mean, the scale of what we're doing. So I don't know how to, you know.
We used to calculate leverage and kind of have it at we can take it.
Present
I'll talk to
that,
about that.
But
you do every deal and then kind of figure out the overall.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell you off the top of my head, in that sample project for the OP redevelopment that we did, we're putting in $1.3 million and leveraging roughly $23 million in private financing. So. Yeah, no, that's 20 to 1.
That's
pretty good numbers.
Very substantial.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. That's great. Of course, that could get this up to many millions.
We'll spend every dollar you give me.
Yeah. Okay, good. Yeah.
Just to the question.
Yeah.
That's their wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
What did we have in this line item for last year? Do you remember?
I think it was pretty close, right? I mean,
are we running about the same? Or?
Yeah, I honestly
think
don't know.
With the exception of OPI,
I
think on the OH, if you went back, I could probably give you ballparks, but it will be over the year over year because we do have that in the packet, so we can look later on.
Right,
yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, for OHA, we have the year over year. Yeah.
Okay, my only comment is concerning the advocacy pieces that we have, which is the bill that you're attempting to work with Nancy Skinner's office for, and also the citywide
overlay zone.
Yes, all of those could be presented to the advocacy tables that we are at, and we could actually, as advocates, support, you know, pushing that
I'd
out.
Be happy to go.
Like EBHO and then maybe Housing California. So,
yeah.
Because they're creating packets of bills to move forward through the legislation. Mm-hmm. Why not include these? Because they sound really good.
Yeah. And for the pilot bill, I mean, my point is even if it takes more than one senator to maybe to make that real.
Of course.
Then why aren't all the senators around the Bay Area or all the assembly people getting behind the idea? Some of it is because they historically have distrust for housing authorities. So there's that to consider. The other thing that I don't think they appreciate is that we have assets that we can leverage into this. In other words, we can go get non-federal private funds, create a revolving loan fund, and use that fund. And I don't think that ever dawns on anyone.
No, it doesn't.
That we could do that. And it's doable. It's an interesting idea. It's a different way of creating affordable housing. You know, when you talk about how are we going to serve people without federal assistance or even state assistance every month, and that's the only way I know how.
It's very smart.
And it's the old public housing method. It was before the Brooks Act in 1968 when they tied it to income. Prior to that, the way you calculated rents in public housing is you took Peralta, had 390 units. You divided the operating expenses for the next year by 390 families, and then you adjusted for family size, and that was the rent you paid.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some of your commissioners can leverage relationships just to be able to start sending out that message. Mm-hmm. I'd love to volunteer to be able to kind of share that with our partners.
The overlay zone, I think we really need help with, and we've got actually people coming on board as consultants to help us with that.
Yeah.
For OPI.
Yeah, so right now we're just working through the initial steps with the city, but once we have something to move forward, it will be all hands on deck, and, and we'll definitely let you know, as well as all the advocacy organizations.
I'm also signing us up in that regard. I'm signing Enterprise up for that. So.
Thank you.
So just in terms of our capital outlay, in 2019, you asked, we had an overall budget of 63, and this year we're proposing 50. So we actually went down. The reason we went down is because we actually shifted the costs, $13 million, from OHA to OPI for rehabs.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
So it's about the same.
I just have one question. It was on slide 18, and I just want a little clarity about the bundling, because I didn't really understand that. I know you explained it very clearly, but... And just maybe you could walk me through it again, just quickly.
Sure, absolutely. So... basically, under the low-income housing tax credit program, you can claim tax credit basis and generate tax credit equity based on the value of a building, but not on the value of land. And that has to do with arcane IRS stuff. I mean, that's what you get when the IRS designs an affordable housing program, right? And so what we're doing is... We're going to take four buildings that we are simply rehabbing, but keeping intact, and pairing it with one building we're tearing down and starting over from scratch on. And so on that one building we tear down, we get no tax credit equity on the existing value of the building, right, because we're demolishing it, so therefore we can't take it. But on the other four buildings, we get the value of acquiring, you know, what we would pay in the open market on an appraised value basis. Which leads to us generating additional equity from the project. And sort of the game is doing enough rehab to make sure the buildings are livable, functional, and preserved, but still less than what you get in terms of the amount of acquisition basis that comes in and acquisition equity that comes in. So whatever is remaining that you don't spend gets to be put towards the new construction project. And right now, because these buildings are worth so much, we feel like we can actually get there and generate substantial amounts of equity that can be used for new construction.
And then it can be used as you build new buildings.
That's right.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I also have a question.
Yeah.
Actually, I have two. One was a comment related to the bundling. The comment about using the PBVs on non-contiguous sites, that comment was not with our preservation, though, because of the existing state law?
So that one more time.
You mentioned that we can use our PBVs on non-contiguous sites.
Yes,
But we couldn't do that now under the current state law provision if it's acquiring market
Market rate, we could not.
Right? So on the preservation front, we couldn't use it still.
Absolutely.
Okay. Just wanted to clarify. Okay.
But I would say that, you know, I mean, we've done some initial looking at a model that might work to acquire and, you know, finance those properties. And right now, you know, FHA mortgage rates are under 4%. Mm-hmm. And so we might have to put a little bit of equity into those properties. But once we acquire them on the line of credit, we can then refinance them using FHA loans, get them off the line of credit, and have them effectively pay for themselves without project-based voucher support. So I think the idea is to have kind of self-sustaining, mm-hmm. you know, market rate properties that, you know, that kind of pay for themselves in this way.
Excellent. Yeah. And then my other question was just about bringing on new staff. And mm-hmm. we currently have an open position, is that right? And then we're
we do. And did you do your staff one? Table? Did that fly by without me interrupting?
Yeah, it was the very beginning.
Because I promised to interrupt him to tell you. Yes, he does have. We do have one vacant that we're hiring. We have another staff in the budget. And what I wanted to do is basically sort of set a stage with you that Dave and I have been in conversations about what will really be needed as we grow the pipeline. It is not the staffing we have now. We're going to need to expand the staff. Mm-hmm. He has a whole plan for that. I thought about bringing it forward in this budget, but we're not going to get it hired this fiscal year. So okay. being judicious, I just said I'm going to throw out to you guys, you will see a different staffing model and new positions in next year's budget to accommodate a lot of these development activities that are going to be going on simultaneously and with different entities. You know, he's working now for OPI, he's working for OHA. We hope to get CAHI involved in that mix. So it's going to be a little broader, and particularly as it relates to something that we're going to throw out at the end of this to see if you guys are interested in, there will be additional work in that.
Okay.
So I would, you know, there's a couple of areas that we're growing. We're going to talk about it in HR. He's only showing one new position.
Right.
Not the vacant one.
Right.
This is new.
The additional one.
This year, but there's going to be more positions next year and a different org structure.
I was just curious how the positions and the work that's being detailed now.
It's a dual capacity. Yeah. It's what do you need now, and then also how long will it take to get the new folks hired and ready to go, and mm-hmm. we just didn't think we'd get to that by the end of this fiscal year. So, okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
So,
I want one question.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. I see what you said. What is for the state soft funds?
Yes, that would be like the programs that HCD administers. So, I think the big one recently has been MHP, which is a multifamily housing program. It's a loan fund that, you know, the state government administers, and it was funded through various propositions, most recently 1C. Then we've got new ones related to the cap and trade program, which is the ASIC, I think they call it. We've got a brand new bond that was passed this most recent election called No Place Like Home that targets homeless folks. So there are a number of different programs that HCD administers. They're administered on a competitive basis. And, you know, my concept there is we, you know, we'll use those funds if we have to. But right now, because we've got our own assets that we can leverage, we can leave those free for another developer to use. And so we're trying to add to the affordable housing ecosystem without draining funds that could be used somewhere else.
Strategy two, there is something about starting with the Hope 6 era. What's available now that replaces that era that could help with speed up with the housing?
Sure. I mean, it's right now the program that's been introduced is a rental assistance demonstration, or RAD. That's really what HUD's focus has been in terms of replacing public housing and redeveloping it. RAD is not a great tool in an area like this to add more units. You know, they basically maintain the existing right. public housing funding levels. And if we can't support public housing on that amount of money now, how are we going to support right. new construction on it later on, right? So it's not an equivalent to Hope 6 by any stretch of the imagination. It's not. Yeah. I don't think it's intended even as a production program, but that's basically what HUD has used to replace it.
But I would, and then in terms of the Section 18 disposition where you get a full voucher, 100% voucher, that's what works for us, mm-hmm. as we've seen with both OPI and we'll see with the senior sites. So within the Section 18 regulation, there are certain things you need to do to get full tenant protection vouchers. And one of them is obsolescence, how you determine obsolescence. And so And he says I came up with the idea. I say he came up with this idea. And one of our counsel in D.C. was out and we were talking about what we can do, and particularly, in, for example, now in West Oakland, where you have townhome style, lots of grass at Peralta, really could look completely different because you are a block from BART, 7 minutes from Embarcadero. So what should that neighborhood be? And we came up with the concept, and I say this so we can pitch the concept, all of us, whenever we want, is that obsolescence should include density. That development on that, those few families on that level of acreage in that neighborhood, it's actually just obsolete because it's too low density.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And that HUD should be able to grant us the vouchers, yes, protection vouchers for the 390 units. Let us take those 390 Section 8 vouchers and roll them into any considerably larger amount by going down, for example, 8th Street in little parcels and building what we did next door at Harrison Senior, what we did at Lakeside Senior, you know, go up five stories, have them on a podium with parking, and start building the neighborhood where it's more in line with its location. So that's a whole long, long, long term. We would never get there if we can't get HUD to determine that obsolescence should include some provision about having 390 units on 60 acres of land.
No, I think that's really important.
Yeah.
So did we agree that last year's budget was, what did you say, $63 million?
And it was roughly the same. What we used to do is book certain capital expenditures, capital outlays were booked on the OHA budget and then reimbursed by OPI. Now they're just paid for by OPI, so that figure of $13 million really left OHA's budget and is just 100% in OPI now. So the amount of investment actually that we made in terms of what Dave's talking about was roughly the same. It's about $50 million.
Oh, I see. So last year we made about 50, which is the same.
Same as this year.
Oh, okay.
Roughly. Yeah.
Okay, I get it. Yeah, I see.
The only difference in the year over year is how we book the money when OPI was not completely autonomous.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
We're doing a lot for this.
Yeah, no, this is good stuff.
All right.
Well, David, thank you.
Well, thank you.
So now we get into the exciting world of programs and MTWs and serving the hardest to serve and trying to make a dent in our city in terms of getting people housed. So I'd like to invite up Andres Manriquez, our Chief Operating Officer, with Michelle Hassan, the Director of Leased Housing, who are going to talk about some of the stuff I love dearly.
Good evening, Chair, Commissioners. My name is Andres Manriquez. I'm going to turn it over to Michelle to start the presentation.
Good evening, Commissioners. Michelle Hassan, Director of Leased Housing. So today we're going to talk about the department structure, what's new, Building Bridges Program, and Owner Incentives Program. So currently I have 94 budgeted positions. I am seeking 3 additional positions that I'll speak about shortly. As you can see, the department is set up where there are 8 teams, and those teams reside on 2 different sides of the department and are assisted by 2 assistant directors. You'll see additional positions there in blue, which are titled advocates, and an additional office specialist position. Again, 94 current budgeted positions, 3 new being requested for a total staff count of 97. And so one of the positions that is being requested is titled advocate, and this position would be 2 individuals who are empowered to address complex issues negatively impacting the lives of residents through one-on-one engagement. And so what we found is that some of our families, as well as owners, need additional and more thorough attention to resolve their concerns. And what has happened in the past is that family member or resident has contacted the department and maybe got 2 or 3 different people that they've talked to. And now 3 people are involved and the family's not getting resolution. The issue gets sent to the executive office, or they call the executive office, we're working on it, but the family's not getting resolution. So what we've developed are positions that take the family from the point of contact with the authority and is a single point of contact. They will assist the family with getting community support, referrals to FCP, reviewing the file, closing out the file, documenting, drafting a final letter to the family, and then reporting up to the executive office the resolution. And we think this really will improve and increase our customer service for families and owners that we serve. So we're seeking two individuals who would support each side of the department. One side does primarily assist eligibility applicants and owners, and the other side of the department assists program participants. And so we think this would be a benefit to our residents and our owners.
And part of this came about, there's different programs that different agencies have had called ombudsman. This is an ombudsman, if you know. I don't like that term, so we're going to find something between advocate and ombudsman, because I can't even barely say it. but I'm going to tell you where what ignited this in me. We've long talked about maybe we need ombudsman, someone who can advocate for somebody. And there's a resident on Section 8 that has come to Michelle and I over the years, and for me it was the third time, on the same issue over the years when it comes up for review. And so she calls the office, and and I call her back, and and she says they're doing this again. Gave them the letter. I don't know who to give it to. They're all just looking at me, and nobody's doing this one thing. And it was about a 504 accommodation. And if you read my letter that Michelle and I drafted literally 4 or 5 years ago at this point, it says what to do, but it's not getting to the person who can say, yeah, this is what we should be doing. And she said, I call you because I need somebody to advocate for me. There's no one inside the department that can advocate. And I think this happens to property owners too. Like, I'm at the counter. Who can I get to come up that can take this and go get resolution? That's what I'm looking at this folks doing. So we can cut down on when you hear people aren't returning my calls, or I can't get someone at the counter, and I went looking for Miss Jones, and Miss Jones wasn't there. She's been out for 3 days, and she's now on extended leave. Where do I go? Who do I talk to? It's kind of that stuff, so that Michelle has someone inside her department, a couple of people inside her department who are really tasked with trying to make sure people get timely responses and they get their issue heard and dealt with. So it's a new thing for us, and I think it may actually be a big benefit to our participants, both landlords and tenants.
I just have one question. I guess it's really a question of how does one get the opportunity to work with the advocate? How would that connection occur?
So generally the way it looks is that the family, even though, let's say the file is stating very specifically the status of the family. So for instance, you request a reasonable accommodation, the accommodation wasn't approved, you had a hearing, the hearing was upheld to not approve it, but you just aren't understanding the why. So there are a number of letters that speak to the why. There's a hearing decision. And instead of the individual having to go back to the hearing officer, the person who drafted the hearing notice, having one person sit down with them and review all of the documents is helpful. And so generally it looks like someone who may just continue to call about the same issue and now has two or three staff trying to support them through a particular concern. What's great is that the managers on all the teams, when we meet, we talk about families who are having challenges with, one, a decision we made, indecisiveness sometimes, right? Or family just that's not able to put the pieces together of the information that we've given them. And so as we hear about those families and know about them, the customer service team will be trained to basically rise that family up to an advocate in the department who can assist them.
So what that translates to in the customer service team are the people who staff the front counter and rotate and answer the phones. So that's how if there's something they're hearing again, or someone's really upset because something's not doing something, or that somebody's not there, they actually have someone they can refer it to who will get back to the person. I think having worked a front counter in my career, that will be a godsend for the folks who are in the booth and on the phone.
Okay.
And there are notes in our system. Every time a family contacts us, mm-hmm. there is a note of that contact. And so you can see, you know, kind of a historical picture of this feeling or sense that the family's not getting their issues resolved.
Mm-hmm. I guess my curiosity is it something that a participant or a family, an owner, can also request, or is it something that's decided by the customer care department?
That's a really interesting thing, because I've seen it done where they have posters in the lobby saying, having an issue, contact ombudsman. Because this is new, we're not certain how we're going to control. What we don't want are the two people so overwhelmed they help nobody. So I think we're going to have to walk gradually into this as a resource. The actual job title is?
Lead Housing Assistance Representative 2.
So it's in the HAR kind of bigger class, but it's one step up. So they can do all HAR work, because we wanted to make sure they actually could get in the system and solve the problem and help out the other HARs who maybe haven't gotten to it because they have a caseload that's mm-hmm. larger. Yeah.
Thank you. The other position is an office specialist 1 position, and this position is to support our MTW initiatives team. And that team administers the owner incentives, the building bridges, and most of our local programs. And this is a new team that was developed this year, fiscal year 19. So I'm going to talk a little bit about our building bridges programs. The Oakland Path, which you may know as our sponsor-based housing assistance program, mm-hmm. the SRO, Service Enriched Housing, Emancipated Foster Youth, THP Plus, and the CalWORKS Homeless Initiative program. And so our Oakland Path Rehousing Initiative sponsor-based is our flagship program. It was developed in 2010 in partnership with the City of Oakland. And currently for fiscal year, currently the funding is at $2 million. And the recommendation for 2020 is an additional $20,000, which would be spent directly on housing subsidy for any of the individuals served through the program. The city funds a service component of $1 million, and that can pay for subsidy costs, security deposits, monthly utility payments, repairs and cleaning, vacancy loss, and some housing placement services. The families that can be served is up to 125, and currently we're at 108. That is basically divided into 100 adults who are currently homeless and living in encampments or exiting the criminal justice system, 25 foster youth exiting the criminal justice system, and then not included in the 125 is a provision for a step down to a housing choice vouchers for those households who need lighter services. And so that frees up some of the comprehensive services that OPRI provides to a new family. We have our next program, the SRO Operating Subsidy Services Enriched Housing. And this was a result of an RFQ that OHA issued, and it invited service-enriched housing providers to submit proposals to participate in an MTW local housing assistance program. Really, the point of this RFP was really to preserve the SRO units that were under threat in downtown and to assist those residents in those units to maintain their housing. There were 3 areas that we focused on: service-enriched SRO units, shared housing units set aside for veterans, emancipated youth, or other special needs programs, and then transitional housing units set aside for veterans, emancipated youth, or other special needs populations. The funding request for 2020 is $3,020,000, and there were 289 units awarded in late 2017 to this program. This is a general location of the SRO locations. As you can see, there really are throughout the city. A number of the buildings we preserved in downtown Oakland, West Oakland, and as well as a number of family units in East Oakland. The CalWORKS and THP Plus program is our newest local program, Building Bridges program. CalWORKS is in partnership with Alameda County Social Services Agency, and the THP Plus Next Steps Collaborative is in partnership with First Place for Youth, who was awarded a contract through Alameda County Social Services. OHA participated in that RFP and then was able to award a contract for 50 slots for emancipated foster youth to First Place for Youth. And so the funding request for 2020 is it's $2.5 million over a five-year term and serves 50 youth per month. CalWORKS, the fiscal year 2020, is $1 million in the budget, $5 million over a five-year term and serving 50 families per month. Moving to our owner benefits program. We have a 6 owner benefits program signing bonus for new owners of $500, a vacancy loss payment, pre-qualifying unit inspections, owner recognition, automatic rent increases, and maintenance loan. We have launched 4 of these 6 incentives. So the signing bonus is a $500 signing bonus for landlords who have not had a contract with OHA in the last 3 years. To date, we have 134 owners and have paid out $68,000 in incentives. The vacancy loss payment is really a way to incentivize owners to re-rent units to Section 8 tenants after the previous Section 8 tenant has vacated the unit. And basically, the owner can get up to 60 days of HAP from the previous tenant if they rent the unit to a new Section 8 tenant. We've had 105 owners participate and have paid out just under $200,000. Pre-qualifying unit inspections, which we call Inspect Now, Rent Later. This allows a landlord to not have a prospective Section 8 tenant when they request an inspection from OHA. We will go out and inspect the unit. The inspection is valid for 60 days. We have performed 936 of those inspections and executed 253 Section 8 contracts as a result of this incentive. Our owner recognition program, it really recognizes long-term owners, generally 5 years and or more. And we have provided certificates of appreciation to 158 landlords and a total number of appreciation plaques to 101 landlords. Just a reminder, this Saturday is our Owner Appreciation Day at 1540 Webster. Within 30 minutes of sending out an email blast, we had already gotten 130 landlords signed up.
Yeah, they love it.
And so it's a great day of owner recognition, and very appreciative landlords are that we're able to recognize them. The capital improvement payment is very close to being launched. One of the things that's important about our incentives is that we make them less burdensome for staff and less paper required in terms of tracking. So this is being set up in our business system, which we recently launched. And this would pay a landlord up to $2,500 to address capital improvements related to HQS fails. Essentially, what we're doing here is trying to assist families to not be displaced. And so the owner gets a zero interest loan over a period of 6 months to 1 year, and they're able to, the family's able to stay in the unit. Our automatic rent increase is the other incentive we hope to launch during fiscal year 20. And this will just focus on small area rental markets. It'll be an automatic rent increase amount, which will be set using multiple data sources such as Go Section 8, Rent-A-Meter, There are a number of sources we can use, and it'll target small targeted geographical areas, and all of those owners in that area would receive the benefit of that rent increase. Comments or questions?
I think this is a real cool thing, because this is what's making the difference between people being, or one of the things between people being able to place a voucher and not. You know, because this is for these people that can't place vouchers, the stress is just absolutely horrible. So I applaud this effort.
Very good.
Yeah, what about the wait time for someone with a voucher? Has that improved?
It has improved. Families, we at one time, we were almost up to 8 months to a year, families finding units. And so while we issue the first voucher for 90 days, we will give an extension to families, and we are giving less extensions for families to find units. So the search time has decreased dramatically.
And have you looked at the Go Section 8 list recently?
Yes. So I think this week we were up to 156 units.
Oh, okay.
And at one time we had two.
City?
Yes. Yeah. So that is absolutely a target that certainly tells us the temperature of the market.
Yes. To the chair.
Thank you.
I concur that these programs are really the heart of what we do, and it really speaks to our creativity and our willingness to say yes when no one else has even thought of that. So, I mean, I would love to push the budget to as much as we can for these programs so that we could really serve that population that is really in need right now. So thank you so much.
And, you know, we did meet today actually with some city folks, Andres and I, to talk about the sponsor base, for example, and some of the what they're doing, and with someone they brought on board as their consultant. The challenge is finding units for the programs. So the capacity isn't just money from our side. It's also the services side from the city or the county. And then it's just, can they locate new units? Mm-hmm. So I think you're going to be coming up against a wall of capacity, meaning what's the capacity of the rental market in the city to deal with this until you can build the units?
Yes.
Yeah, I just have a question about the PAP participants. Currently homeless and living in an encampment, do we actually help that's living in an encampment, and how do we?
So yes, Commissioner Montgomery, one of the partners in the PATH partnership basically goes out, Operation Dignity, to homeless encampments and meets the families where they are, or the individuals where they are, and then continues to engage them over a period of time until trust is built and they're willing to come in and complete very minimal paperwork and do a background screenings for a sex registrant. That's all we do. And then the housing search process starts. So yes, they are going under the overpasses, wherever they know those families or individuals are.
And we actually help. That's very good.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. Yes. Moving on, we have a brief report that we added because we know it's a long meeting and we know there's a lot of slides, but I wanted Andreas and Mark just to talk a little bit. Mark Schifferl, our Director of Property Operations, to talk a little bit about the public housing side. And I would tell you that public housing is important, even though we don't have a lot of units, but that we do well in REAC and that we do our vacancy rate, which is also great overall. They're important because they actually get scored under the new MTW proposal. So they may become even more important in the future that we make sure we still are a high performer on those. So I'll turn it over.
Thank you, Commissioners. Mark Schifferl, Director of Property Management. I do have a brief presentation, two slides. Much to the delight of my colleagues. So I'm here to talk to you about the public housing budget summary. There's a slide that will
walk you through that. And then I also wanted to show you the REAC score review. Both slides reflect the benefits of having MTW designation and how we can move things around as an agency to better fund public housing. So as you look at this slide, it details from fiscal year 2015 how at the bottom you see we had a net income projected of negative $5,904,770, showing in fiscal year 2020's budget $161,350 positive. I wanted to point out that, you know, we do have increased tenant income over the course of from 2015 to 20. That's due to the increased occupancy, so we're at a level in the high 98s, as you can see in the monthly reports that come through. And I would also key that into increased tenant portions from their recertifications. So the CFP grant allocation is what really changed to help us level out. So if you look, there was only $250,000 budgeted for that in fiscal year 2015, where we now shifted money from the capital fund grant allocation directly into this account for fiscal year 2020.
To say that, so you understand, the capital fund grant was was discrete. What we've done is say it's a public housing earned grant, and it goes away when you, like the RAD deal takes that into effect. So what we're doing is basically giving all of the public housing dollars to the public housing sites. So that's how, that's why that shift, to try and get to as close to budget neutral in the public housing program as we can.
No, where does that come from?
They changed the rules. And we're able to take all of the capital fund and move it that is earned by the public housing program use it for operations. Before, we had to move it over to development activities,
and
certain capital activities.
So this is how, that's the reason public housing has suddenly become break even.
Yeah, pretty much.
Right. Correct. So I wanted to highlight
that
for you in one
slide
today.
Really interesting. Is this going to be permanent?
Yeah. Yeah, as long as we have
a
capital
fund.
So,
then it's not like such a stress out to get rid of the public housing.
And what we're not doing is using, what we're not doing is some game change of saying we had a net loss of $5.9 million, almost $6 million last year, so we're going to take MTW money and we're going to put that on top of it. Because these other capital funds were restricted, so then we're going to try and draw them down for development activities when they don't. And what we wanted to do is make the capital fund as whole as we could make it based on its funding sources and then see how much money it needs to stay in good shape and afloat. And I think that shift is a big chunk of it. And it's and it's also more tenant accounts receivable, tenant paying, but it's also the occupancy rate. You know, those all impact the performance of this.
So basically then the $5 million is not new money. This is really just a reclassification.
Right. Because
so
on the budget, that's true. Yeah.
And then in return for that, MTW was sending the money over to public housing.
Right. Yeah, and so you get a 5.3 difference on that one.
Yeah. Okay.
And then, but then you also have $655,000 on tenant income that's gone up. So we're doing better rent collection.
Okay, right.
And in operating subsidy, meaning the units are occupied, we get another $1 million because the units are occupied. So there's, we're doing all those things at once, and I think it just really has a nice picture on the.
It has a nice picture.
Yeah.
Seen public housing.
Right. You've never seen it to the point where it's a net of 161.
It looks great. Do we maintain a certain reserve for capital improvements?
We do,
and
when we finish this, I'm going to hand out the estimated that we do every year reserve schedule, and we'll walk you down where we've established reserve funds for all of our sites, all of our programs, actually.
Cool.
So the next slide I wanted to highlight where we've come with the REAC scores from 2007 through the last REAC that we had. Kind of gives you a picture of evolution pre-OP disposition. Including all of that in there, and money and how we funneled it. So you got Lockwood and Peralta starting out from 07 all the way through the last REAC. And so in this year's budget, you'll see in some of the capital projections and the budget forecasts, I have asked for money because we are due for our next REAC inspection in 2020. So we're planning ahead and we're able to do that. With that extra money that we can.
And the way they do REAC inspections now, if you see the empty boxes, if you get 90 or higher, They come back once every 3 years. If you get 80 or higher, 80 to 90, they come back every 2 years. If you're below 80, then they come every year. So Lockwood this year got to 90, and it was for whatever reason Lockwood was getting hit with a couple things that were just we were just so close. I mean, and we finally got the units taken care of, and this, but it's mostly the site stuff. It could be erosion, it could be, you know, a tree hitting a building, and you get a whole site deduction. But we're both above 90, so it's 2017, so we have 3 years until we get the next inspection, which means 2020, which means Mark's back on, so he had to budget for REAC because we got to get out there and make sure everything's perfect. They have changed the rules for REAC because, and this is the new administration, I don't know that I totally disagree, but they're not, in the past, they used to put out these reverse bids so that you could tell when they were bidding your sites that they would award it in 2 weeks, and we'd get a call from the awarded inspector in about 4 weeks, and it would probably be between now and now. The REAC rules are supposed to be in the last quarter of your fiscal year. So for us, that's April 1st to the 30th. But they get behind and they get ahead, so you're never really sure, so you watch it. But now they're cutting down the notice, so the inspector's not going to give you the same number of notice, not going to call you in April and say, I'm coming out at the end of May. They're going to give you a very limited notice. So you really have to be ready to give. Yeah, you do. And so the sites really need to make sure that we get everything prepped and keep it prepped so that during the window, because you couple graffiti things, they can tag the whole site and you lose the 90.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So that could just happen overnight.
And it does. We have staff arriving at 5 o'clock in the morning painting out graffiti every single REAC inspection.
It is all hands-on.
That I have ever been a part of.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
And you'll probably see Andres and myself there for about 2 weeks prior, making sure that we kind of hit everything and kind of touch the entire property. Staff are very well
prepared. Erosion, for whatever reason, was always big at Lockwood, and that we have to do one approach. Some of it is putting bark. But
yes.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I just wanted to highlight this and show you kind of where the budget's going to be at this year and why we have some extra capital that's going into the Lockwood and Peralta budgets for public housing.
Very cool.
Thank you.
Excellent.
And thank you, Mark.
And thank you very much.
Very clear.
And next we have, I know, another department that the board's very fond of, and I'll ask Lenita Wheeler to come on out for Family and Community Partnerships and go over her year and what it looks like.
Evening. I'm Lenita Wheeler, your Director of Family and Community Partnerships Department. What you have before you are the main program areas for FCP. I do want to point out that the life enrichment may not be super obvious, but that includes things such as our health and wellness. It includes our computer labs, supporting families with basic needs, safety net needs, like food, transportation. And please note that each of the FCP program areas are supporting our MTW activities in the area of incentivizing and or increasing self-sufficiency. This here is the department leadership structure. And the increase in grants that we have received has required that the manager position be split into two. Formerly, all of these programs are under one manager. However, with the increased reporting, the increased grant funding, we've split it into two. And so there's one manager of special programs that covers site intervention, civic engagement. And then the second manager is more traditional, if you would, supporting family self-sufficiency, homeownership, and the ROS program. The other area where you will see some increase in the departmental structure is with respect to a second senior management analyst, which is way over to the right of the org chart. Again, this is due to one of them being split out, who focuses specifically on invoices, budget, grant drawdowns, and the other is focusing on data, case management systems, reporting systems, things like our Yardi and how Yardi needs to interface with our grants and the system that we use to document client notes, as well as they support and teach the team on managing the data for all of our grants as well. And then I'm also pleased to report that we've recently been awarded a second ROS program coordinator. Traditionally, we have had one for the last several years, And now with the advent of Jobs Plus, we are also including those public housing sites at our West Oakland Jobs Plus sites, and they determine the number of coordinators that you're eligible for based off of the number of public housing units. And so that increased, and we just slid right under the radar by about like 20, 25 units or something like that, but it still counts, and the work is still there, and we've been granted a second ROS coordinator position, and I am still going to work very hard to apply for the fifth family self-sufficiency coordinator position. We do justify it, however, HUD has determined the last couple of years that they have not been increasing existing awards. They've been keeping them steady. So I do hope that changes in the upcoming future. This slide is just showing you the growth in the department over the last several years. You're seeing 2013, there were 12 staff persons, and now there are 25. And this does not include the interns that we have supporting us in each of our programs. You see that we've added new programs in the last several years, Jobs Plus. Site intervention is now with family and community partnerships. We are building out an eviction prevention program with our property management partners and now host on-site hours at 1540 Webster Street. We're there every Monday after the Flex Friday, which are high volume times for them or people have questions about services. You'll see there the additional new positions that I had referenced, as well as a new technology that we're using to support the department. So we are looking to move the case management system where we take our resident notes to the cloud, which would allow our coordinators the flexibility to enter those notes when they're off site and not be tied or directly connected to the OHA network, but they could just be connected to the internet, as well as each of the staff having OHA-issued cell phones, again, for increased communication and safety and access to what's going on, as well as tablets, which are much more lighter and flexible than the laptops, and our robocall system, which we use to communicate with our families en masse. We're learning that the trends in how people are interacting with us are changing over time. Website, they're not so much going to the OHA website to find information. They're texting us, they're using apps, and they are responding to emails, and so we are in kind responding, and we've increased our budget for robocall system, quite frankly. And it is still personal, so you can record your own voice. It's not an actual robot, so we do get good responses because of that.
Yeah, cool.
Mm-hmm. You'll see here some of the program goals for Jobs Plus. They're not all here, but I do want to let you know if you see a dash in any area, that's because our grant doesn't actually have that specific measurement that we track in our quarterly reports to HUD, but we are tracking it ourselves because it is helpful information for us. And you'll see that we are on target for a bulk of our grant goals. We are anticipating, well, not anticipating, but we will be requesting an extension. Currently, the grant is through December 31st of this year, 2019. We've been in conversations regularly with our grant liaison and have let them know that we will be applying for an extension of 1 year, which would allow us to continue to spend down the funds. We've been given permission by you all, thank you very much, in our last year budget cycle to add two additional coordinators, project positions funded by the grant term to support the Jobs Plus program, as well as a developer, a job developer who has supported us significantly. I would like to point out that this job developer has assisted us with 19 separate employment events in 2018, three recruitment events. There's a job club that's been established. They also have tables now at our block parties. They have not only job fairs, but also the fair to prepare you for the job fair so you know how to interact and maneuver through, as well as a leader's workshop. It's resulted in 2018 alone in 196 hires of our residents with all of these efforts, 19 of them Section 3. We've had employers such as TSA, FedEx, the U.S. Census Bureau, Amazon, the Oakland A's, UPS, they have all hired sometimes our residents on site directly at the job fair. And so we're very pleased with that. And you'll continue to receive updates about how the Jobs Plus program is going in our regular monthly reports. You'll see here just some fun photos of our education initiative. We have Family Literacy Night and Parent Workshops. You all are very familiar with our partnership with the Oakland Unified School District, as well as the five focus areas that our education initiative has. So we focus on enrolling in kindergarten on time, attending school every day and on time, a third grade literacy, graduating high school, and the opportunity to enroll in college and or vocation. We have increased our efforts on focusing on literacy and parent engagement, and so we now host family literacy reading nights. We receive small grants from the Oakland Literacy Council to support us with that, as well as supporting our parents with their own educational attainment, their own mental health support needs, anxiety, post-traumatic stress. These are showing up regularly in the case management meetings that our families are having, as well as the meetings they're having with the wraparound services at the school district. And our children are doing wonderfully with increasing their attendance, and we're recognizing the need to also provide the same amounts of supports for their parents. We currently have 7 ambassadors at 7 partner schools, and we're also pleased to report that the Jobs Plus has a youth program. There are teenagers who are also focusing on civic engagement and employment. They've done cleanups in the community at Peralta. They're currently dabbling in the name right now. They're on Youth ROC, which stands for Reaching Our Community Kids. They're working with our communications manager on coming up with a logo for themselves. And then Director Johnson mentioned earlier, and I answered some questions earlier with respect to summer youth employment. We did put out a bid earlier this year around the holiday, and we will present later on to you the request for 2 contracts to be approved. I did, when I went back to the seat, have a little birdie in my ear, i.e. our police chief, let me know that legally young people cannot be drug tested, which is why it doesn't take place specifically for employment. So as it relates to employment, anyone under the 18, it's not legal to drug test them. However, if you're over 18, certainly if it's related to the job spec, such as you're going to be placed in an employment setting or something of that nature, it is legal at that point. But nevertheless, in the event we do have a young person who is struggling, they will receive case management services if that's a need for them. So I did want to make sure I let you guys know that. And then also letting you know with respect to parent enrichment services and youth enrichment services, we provided over 2,200 lunches and snacks in the summer last year to roughly 100 of our young people. Here are some statistics with respect to how we're currently doing with our Oakland Unified School District partnership with reducing chronic absenteeism. And we did, prior to the Oakland Unified School District strike, we did have 42 of our students, which is about half of them, with satisfactory attendance. Satisfactory attendance is 95 to 100%. Unfortunately, with those several weeks out of school, old habits did return, and we are now down to only 4 of our students having satisfactory attendance. So we are going to continue to work those muscles and support our families with rebuilding those habits, with staying on time and getting to school every day. But that was a setback that we did take. But we did not lose anyone in the program, which we do think is really good.
And it is interesting to note, we've been meeting with some other education experts around town, because we like to learn. They said this is very true across the district and across charter schools. This is not just our population in this one program. And I was sort of stunned. I thought, what?
So people were on vacation? Or?
Well, I don't know. They lost the discipline of showing up on school every time, every day, ready to learn.
It's like,
and
that
so the district
memory.
Had the same thing, and charter school had the same thing. They said, no, we found the same thing.
It's very interesting.
It's like they say, once you start moving, keep moving, because if you stop, it's much harder to start up again.
Right.
You should also know that this is representing our young people's statistics, but throughout the year, we did have 50 of our adults enroll in some sort of educational program, and 10 of them graduated. And those were from community colleges, from state colleges, from private colleges, CSU, UC. And so we are going to continue to support our adults as well as our children with their educational attainment. And we also passed out 513 backpacks last school season. And we have orientations along with that. 45 heads of households participated in those orientations, which resulted in 40 new families enrolled in our Promise Plus program. So our back to school campaign does yield great results for us.
Cool.
Life enrichment. I'd like to share with you Transportation right now is a significant need that our families are requesting help and support with us on. Throughout the last year, we supported families 617 times with transportation needs, which is averaging about $65 each time. I don't want you to do the math because it may scare you just a little bit, but we are spending significant amounts of money with helping our families get to and fro. Same thing with respect to food. We're supporting about 30-ish or so families throughout the year with food insecurity, and this is separate from the food pantries. We do encourage them to apply for their SNAP benefits as well as sign up for our food pantries, and we often have at our food pantries social service providers as well as our health nurses through Samuel Merritt University. And the other area where there's another basic need is with respect to clothing. And so I am pleased to report that we do have a partnership with Burlington where we can provide individuals with a paper voucher, which serves as money for them. And they literally go shop, they hand Burlington the voucher, and at the end of the month, Burlington will send to the housing authority the invoice, and our families are able to shop, and they're also able to shop tax-free because that's through our foundation. We have increased support, as I mentioned, for physical and mental health services for our families, as well as an increase in child care assistance. We're supporting individuals about 50%. A 50% subsidy for child care is about $400 to $600 a month, depending on where they're getting a provider. And also, our senior services have been increasing. Those needs are around protection of predatory financial and lending, as well as individuals in the home, maybe not authorized, taking advantage of them. We've partnered with Adult Protective Services and some other senior providers who are supporting us there with educating them and protecting them, as well as closing our digital divide. Our computer labs were accessed nearly 1,200 times last year. This is all of our computer labs at the public housing sites. We currently have a grant through AB 1299, which allows us to hold three cohorts, one for seniors, one for working adults, and one for youth, where they're learning basic computer services, everything from what the computer looks like on the inside to how to use Word, Excel, the internet, and at the conclusion of their learning session, they're able to take that computer home. And then we also partner with the school district and Tech Exchange with connecting them to low-cost internet services. Again, some photos regarding our food pantries. Samuel Merritt Nurses held 19 health and wellness workshops last year. St. Mary's Center provided 68 senior fitness workshops. And we've also have recently partnered with our mobile mammogram by Women Empowering Women. This year, we've hosted our second annual retreat for the Resident Advisory Board. It took place today. There were 11 meetings for RAB last year, and they held five listening sessions. Those are going to continue. We had 20 workshops for the Neighborhood Orientation Workshop, and our volunteers provided nearly 1,100 hours of service to us, helping with our myriad of events. And I'd also pleased to report we've had 9 individuals open a bank account for the very first time last year.
Cool.
This is the work of our site intervention team. They host housing search workshops, 11 of them in 2018 for 84 of our voucher holders. Michelle Hassan spoke briefly about how the search time has reduced in the past several months. We've also been supporting the OHA staff with getting additional training with respect to mental health. 52 individuals attended a mental health training. And we've received 119 referrals for various lease compliance, mediation, counseling, substance abuse treatment from our property management partners, and 86 of those were completed. We're still working on an additional 30 or so there. These are the current contracts that the Family and Community Partnership has. Our Rising Sun Energy Center is completing our pre-apprenticeship training contract. Civicore Schools is a school supporting young individuals with completing their education, and they're placed here in the Housing Authority to work alongside us in internships. And later on in this meeting, we will be presenting to you the two contracts for the Summer Youth Employment, which is Lau Family Community Development, Inc. and Youth Employment Partnership, Inc. Our contracts have been reduced slightly, being with the building bridges now all being under the umbrella of leased housing, so we no longer have those contracts with First Place for Youth and the City of Oakland. We also no longer have the City of Oakland for the summer youth employment. We will be seeking additional RFPs to support with housing search, out-of-school time activities, and some sort of technology app to support with our resident employment, if you would.
So that Lau family community, is that targeting the Lau community?
That is targeting all of our residents.
Yeah, they don't know. They're
targeting everyone.
Yeah, they're on 12th Street, and they targeted everyone. We were a very strong partner during the Hope 6 Days. We know them extremely well. We think they do wonderful work, and they assist everybody.
I've heard really good things about them. But I just also know that that is a population in Oakland.
It was the Lau family who started it is actually why it's called
Lau. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Cool.
This is just a smattering of partnerships. You know, it takes a village to do all of this work. We need lots of help. We need lots of partnerships. We got to link up. Some that are not there are UC schools, UC Berkeley, San Francisco State, and San Jose State Universities, as well as HERA. We are seeking to strengthen our partnerships with our health providers, particularly as it relates to adult mental health, physical health, and substance abuse treatment. And we also would like to have some on-site support for individuals seeking trauma or with trauma and anxiety. Oftentimes, they're currently waiting weeks for an appointment, and by the time the appointment comes up, maybe they're not as inclined to go and get the help and services. So we're looking for some partners who can respond more immediately to us. And then finally here, you'll see that we have our grants. Family Self-Sufficiency is currently funding 4 of our coordinators. We had 41 enrollments last year, 17 graduates, which also means 17 individuals no longer receiving TANF or traditional welfare benefits. You will be pleased to know that last year we distributed $323,987,000.68 in escrow disbursements of graduates, which is an average of $19,000 per individual. And we've had 18 new escrow accounts established. There's currently 130 people who have an escrow account right now who are enrolled in the program, and those are averaging $6,900. We will be working on some MTW activities to redesign our Family Self-Sufficiency program to help increase those numbers. We mentioned earlier how we've been granted a second coordinator for the ROS program. You're well familiar with our Jobs Plus, and the California Advanced Services Fund is the funder for our AB 1299 grant, which is helping us close the digital divide. And I referenced briefly the Oakland Literacy Council that is supporting us with our family literacy reading nights. This is the overall FCP budget, grants coming in, operating transfers, as well as the percentages that it's breaking down as it relates to our staffing, administration, program, and other expenses. I am more than happy to answer any questions or entertain your comments. Thank you.
I have a question, Chair.
Sure.
The eviction prevention.
Yes.
What does that look like for you guys? Just people who get lease violations?
It's currently we're working with our property management partners with identifying those who are behind in their rent and what data can we pull and what can we put in place to try and prevent that from occurring with our individuals and what types of interventions are available now for those who've already found themselves in a sticky place.
So the resident manager would meet with them or you guys
right now it's a collaborative effort between property management, family community partnerships, leased housing, legal. We've met twice and we're beginning to draft based off of all of their feedback with educating us about the needs that they have. Some suggestions or things as for individuals have communicated with them, you know what, I just hold money, it burns a hole in my pocket. Can you just take it from me from the beginning? And it's possible. Right. We can look into payee services that they could sign up for to where they don't run into those problems. We have some individuals who've acknowledged, I'm just not really good at reading my ledger and math. And so we can have workshops for them, as well as financial literacy we can have regularly for them. And so these are some of the types of ideas that have come to us as suggestions from our property management partners on how we can better support individuals with feeling more comfortable and empowered about paying their rents on time.
And you're hoarding, do you guys just give referrals to support groups? I mean, that's one of the biggest issues in housing is the hoarders, and I know most
of them get evicted.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so that's what made me think of the eviction prevention.
That's correct.
Most of ours now are hoarders who are on our eviction rolls, so.
Where we're able to have the families give us the permission, we're supporting them with any storage and boxing, particularly when there's health and safety challenges in their home and their ability to pass HQS. Those who are willing to attend, they are given referrals. We've created some partners that also support us with hazardous waste cleanup, and we are also being very intentional with identifying some additional mental health partners that would support us as we recognize this as an illness for many of our families, and it's just beyond our ability.
You were talking about mental health partners, and we've been partnering with peers. I didn't see you had them listed on your list, but they've helped us with some of our hoarding issues.
Thank you for that.
Because some of them are recovering hoarders.
Yes.
And so they're able to talk to some of our residents. So.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, actually, in the meeting that we had, you know, today with the city, that was also one of the asks, you know, to deal with hoarding. There's many other communities that are, you know, they do devote a lot of resources to this, and you know, this is not one of them. We would like for that to change.
Did you have a question, comment?
In regards to eviction services, does that include partners with the tax credit properties as well?
Or the current focus right now is for the families in our public housing units and our OP units managed by our property, our OPO, and a small subset of Section 8, but the bulk of the individuals in Section 8, Michelle does have a special team in her department that is supporting those individuals.
Okay, thank you.
Great, thank you, Lolita.
Yes, Andres. I'd like to thank you.
Just one. Is our ambassador program still a pilot? Because it hasn't grown very much. We still have only 7 schools.
That is correct. We still have 7
schools. We're still in pilot mode?
Yeah, and we are actively looking at how do we scale that up.
We are actively doing that. And okay. It's, and we actually call them education ambassadors now.
Okay, sorry.
All right, thank you both. We'll have...
I just wanted to make one comment, point one thing out. This is partly because I've been here so long, but the Housing Authority did not always have this organization. We did not always have family and community partnerships. So, I mean, as I look through this thing, the presentation, I mean, this is a super big deal because this organization started with like 1 or 2 people, and it started growing and growing and growing, and now it has become a really amazingly effective, game-changing operation. And so it's really important to not lose sight of these things, that this is really a startup within OHA not that many years ago, and now it's blossomed into something really remarkable. So thank you very much. Very cool.
Thank you.
Yeah. So now we're going to be joined by Drew Felder, our Director of Human Resources, who's got a couple of slides just to show you about the staff changes, because we're actually adding staff this year. So usually we've stayed flat. We've done reclassifications, haven't gone above a number, but we needed to actually grow this year. So I thought it would be worthwhile to have him come up and just review quickly what those are. Take it away, Drew.
Good evening, Commissioners. Drew Felder, Director of Human Resources. Okay. So for fiscal year 2020, we're proposing to increase our total staff count or position count from 371 to 376. And that will be an increase of 5 positions across 3 different departments, which I've highlighted here, Family and Community Partnerships, Office of Real Estate Development, and Leased Housing. The directors of each of the departments have already spoken to these additions in more detail during their excellent presentations. So I would like to be clear, this is just a summary, it's a recap, this isn't in addition to what everybody else has already spoken to. Okay. Over the next few slides, I'm going to highlight each position and give a very brief high-level overview of the essence of each position and why it's being requested. So starting with Family and Community Partnerships, there will be one Resident and Community Services Coordinator added to that department. And the essence of this position is that it focuses on case management and outreach to OHA families. This position is being requested in order to fully utilize some additional funds that were awarded through a ROS grant, which is a Resident Opportunities and Self-Sufficiencies grant. And this additional money totals to $82,000. And unlike the other positions that I'm going to speak to tonight, this position's salary is completely funded by the grant. So it does not cost or cause us to have any increase in our administrative salaries line item in our budget. So next I'm going to speak to the Office of Real Estate Development. In this department, we were looking to add one senior development project manager. And this position is responsible for managing development projects and ensuring compliance with all the state, federal laws, and regulations. With the current load of development plans, this department's project managers are essentially functioning, as Dave Cadu mentioned earlier, at capacity. With an additional project manager on board, the department will be able to take on all the planned new projects, such as 2530 and 9th Avenue, Brooklyn Basin, and the Empyrean Towers, which were mentioned earlier. And in addition to taking on these projects, we'll also be able to have the bandwidth to take advantage of any new things that might come along that are unexpected.
Cool.
So there's three total positions in the leased housing department. Two of which are going to be the advocate, leased housing advocate, which we mentioned earlier. And right now, the working title for that is a leased housing assistance representative two. So there's two of these positions in leased housing. And as Michelle Hassan spoke to earlier, this position is going to function as a single point of contact to walk residents and owners hand in hand through some of the more complex issues that might arise to make sure that nothing falls through the cracks. Okay. And the aim of this position is to increase the authority's level of customer service and significantly reduce the need to terminate any participants from any of the programs. Okay. Lastly, the office specialist. There's only one office specialist being requested to be at the leased housing department. This position provides some pretty critical clerical support to all the different teams in the department. And with the current responsibilities that leased housing has, much like in ORED, the office specialists that are currently in the department are working pretty close to capacity. And we have these new initiatives coming on board through MTW, such as building bridges and owner benefits, and this position is going to be able to ensure their success to make sure none of the paperwork or any of the clerical support services go undone. Mm-hmm. So with these five new positions, the authority will be able to, at worst, maintain and, at best, improve the level of service in the face of both planned and unexpected changes moving forward. Okay. That is the conclusion of my summary. Are there any questions or comments? No?
No, I think that's excellent. We're doing a lot with very modest personnel growth, so absolutely. I think yeah. that's...
We have to. Thank you very much, yeah, Drew. Thank you. I appreciate it. So now we get to the actual budget, and so... Well, it's interesting to know where it all came from. So he's going to invite the budget team up, but I would tell you that it's been this has been our budget team now for 2 years, and they have made my life so much easier and pleasant during this whole process. So come on up, all three of you. Victor can introduce him. While he's doing that, by the way, I'm going to hand out the actual what we have is our current estimated reserve schedule for the end of the conversation. Just because I want to get it to you before we get there, so I'll turn it over. Victor, take it over.
Good evening, Commissioners. Director Johnson. My name is Victor Madamba, Director of Finance, here to present the fiscal year 2020 budget. Before I start, I want to thank staff who contributed in putting this budget together, Albert Chang, Vicki Cullen, Jonathan Young is not here, and Carolyn Barnett is not also present tonight, but thanks to them who assisted our putting this together for the fiscal year 20, and in addition, also department heads, directors who've also contributed in this process. So let's go and work through the PowerPoint presentation. Total income for the year fiscal year 2020 budgeted at $356,184,000. Of that,
that's
that's
a rough visual.
It is really hard to read.
It's got a little blur in it.
It's still really hard to read.
Still small.
Oh. No, this is. I mean, I got decent vision.
So I think we did this so you don't just.
To refer you to what is also in the packet, we have the year-over-year.
Year-over-year.
Which has the same figures.
Oh, okay.
We also have the next one, which I did write 1, 2, and 3 on them this year. I didn't get it electronically, but I did my best. The second one, the large fold-out you've seen before, this is just OHA by department across the table.
Yep.
And just because we may get there and want to talk about it, we always do the entire one for this meeting, which is the big one. Which we'll get to, where you learn about how large this agency has become. It's a little historic. And then just the staffing list that Drew went over. So we have 1, 2, and 3, but I think if you look at 1 and the first part of 1.
What are we looking at now?
It matches. We're talking. We're at the top where it says total total income.
Oh yeah.
Yes. So it's 1 on the. It's all green on the first page.
This is 1 where we have account descriptions going down the left side.
Turn it over.
Right. Turn it over.
Yep. That's where we are.
More account descriptions.
Yeah, where it says it's. It starts with tenant income, tenant rent, and it goes down.
Yeah,
and I think that's the closest slide we're looking at. Yep.
So we'll use that slide then, or that report to.
Oh, that's what messed me up. I was looking at it from the backside.
Yeah.
Wondering where the revenue was. Okay, now I see.
And if you remember the way we color code this is green is income, blue is expenditure.
Cool.
So when you get to the light blues and the dark blues, that's expenditure. When it's in green, it's income. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Let's go back again. So for fiscal year 2020. Our revenue budget is $356,184,714. Of that, $286,767,000 is our grant income budget. And $5 million of that amount is tenant income, which is a total of $356,184,000.
So what he did is walk you up the chart. If you go to the orange column, that matches the screenshot. The total income, the amount that we get from grants, which is Section 8 HAP, and the amount we get from tenant income.
Okay.
So from the bottom up.
Yeah, okay. The grant word threw me off there.
Yeah.
I see. So that's like our standard revenue stream from HUD.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Okay. Next slide. Or next page, I think, on the
That's good. Sheet. Yep.
This is actually 2 pages over, so you go.
Page three.
We wanted to highlight miscellaneous admin expenses.
On these pages?
No. You know, that is an oversight. The executive director will take personal responsibility.
All right, cool.
But if you go to the third page, it says in dark blue, it says miscellaneous admin expenses, and that's where he is.
Wait a minute. Let me see. It says miscellaneous admin expenses. Where's that? Wait a minute.
Yeah, of the total administrative expenses of $48,548,000, which is page 3 on the year-to-year report, of that, $70,974 is other miscellaneous admin expenses.
Oh, I see where we are.
And the detail of the other miscellaneous admin expenses is 4 items. Tuition reimbursements, cost of credit reports, minor tenant claims, and small infrequent expenses for a total of $70,974.
Not well relevant, right.
Any questions?
Okay.
Move along? Okay.
No.
Oh.
They are down a little bit. There was one reason for them, and I can't remember what it was.
It's not enough to worry about.
Okay.
I mean, this is like $1 billion operation now, so, $70,000.
So what he's now is moving down to the next dark blue line, tenant services, which is split along the next 2 pages.
Right, got it.
Tenant services budgeted at $2,659,000. Utility expenses. $1,955,000. Next page. Ordinary maintenance expense budgeted at.
I got lost where the hell we are.
I went too fast.
So he's just walked us down through the total tenant services and expenses. And if you look at the orange column, number B, it's $2.6 million. Utilities are nearly $2 million now for this agency, by the way, a year, which is pretty high. Anyway, then he gets to another one called ordinary maintenance expenditures, right?
Total maintenance.
So you're okay. So that's but it's not titled that in this thing. So that means you have to go all the way to
page 6.
Page 6. There's a light blue line followed by a dark blue line, and this is.
Anything.
Page six.
Can I ask one quick question?
Yeah.
Yes. All right, go ahead.
14,000 in 19, and we went to 71,000. Just, it's probably not a big deal. Just yeah. Need to know.
For which line item?
Which line item?
Oh, ordinary maintenance and operations overtime.
Where are you? Oh, the 80% increase between that. It's ordinary. It's right under ordinary maintenance. Ordinary maintenance and operations overtime went from 14 to 17. So there's a variance of 80%. I'm not sure what drove that. It could be overtime.
The way we're trending. Oh, excuse me, Vicki Colon, accounting officer too in the finance department. So with our current fiscal year trends, our actuals. Are what drove that number to increase. So what we've budgeted now in Lockwood is $30,000 for overtime and also $30,000 in Peralta.
And that relates to REAC, right, Mark?
Yes, sir.
That's the REAC cost to get ready for REAC.
You had to pull in all hands on deck. I know.
Yeah. That's the cost Mark was talking about.
Is coming out next year?
This is next year.
Oh, this is?
This is next year.
Got it.
Just to keep you on your toes.
But that's a good catch. And if there's any other variants you want to know about, holler out, and we can see what we know about it.
Yep. But there's a big variance with publications that I wanted to know.
That was a shift in funding. Because it was doubly booked, and we didn't, you know, it was booked some in Greer's, some in Family and Community Partnerships, and we've consolidated that is the reason.
Okay,
moving along, page six. Total maintenance expenses for the year is $11,152,000 budgeted. Next page, general expenses of $5,042,000. No, next page.
Is everyone on the same page?
Oh, I thought.
Okay. So the page we're on now, the very first line item is account number 4500-00. That's at the very top.
And they're sequential, so if you're not there, you can flip.
4500.
The first four numbers.
00000.
So if you're looking at 4-3, you're not there yet. Yeah.
Just under total maintenance expenses.
Yeah.
Yeah, right underneath total maintenance expenses. Right.
Oh, not the same? Okay, sorry.
Thank you.
The pages are different.
So total maintenance expenses went up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But importantly, the expenses are not going up faster than revenue.
<That's> Yeah.
Okay. So general expenses, general expenses for the year is budgeted at $5,042,000. Okay. Following is the protective services expenses. That's the police department, budgeted at $6,702,000.
It's very interesting that that only went up by 2%.
It is.
I mean, that's...
I approved a car, I think. Did I do a car?
Yeah. I mean, one. Carol, what are you doing there that you're not... What are you not doing?
No, most of that is just attributable toward increased salaries and COLA. There's very little new in his budget. Okay. It's holding steady. There are a couple of tech things he's doing, but that's about it, right? Some cameras.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Moving along.
It's good.
Total housing payments budgeted at $223,674,000 for the
year. And Victor's reading you the total rather than the lined items. If you go to housing assistance payments, which is line starts with 4700 under the HUD accounting system.
Right.
So the big one are housing assistance payments, and that's the MTW fund that we get. In 2019, we budgeted $191 million and change, and this year we're budgeting $214 for rent increases. So that 11% increase is because of escalating costs of the program.
Wait a minute. What are we looking at there? Because I'm looking at this blue line total.
Right below productive, where it says protective services, it has housing assistance payments, and you have line 4715.
Yeah,
that's the HAP dollar, and that's the increase in the HAP.
Oh, okay.
Expense, not the income.
Expense, right.
Yeah. Yeah, for the vouchers.
Okay.
Okay.
So that went up.
That went up 11%.
1 percentage point faster than revenue was growing.
Last year, what we budgeted, the HAP
expense was based on the $1,200 half rent, whereas this year it went up by $180. $180 resulted in roughly about $27 million difference.
Think about that. The other thing this line, this series of 4715 has is a series of the building bridges programs, the landlord bonus, all of those are also budgeted in this if you go down. And that's how we end up with the $223 million.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. So there's some additive items in there.
Yeah, there's the MTW items. Yeah.
Right, yes. Okay, good. Okay. I understand.
All right, move along.
Yeah.
No questions. So.
Yes, yes.
Where are we?
Allocation.
Huh?
Allocation.
Total non-routine expenditures or non-operating items.
So to walk through the chart you're looking at, we have the total non-routine expenses at $299,734,669. That's just below the housing assistance payments where we were, the next line down. Everyone see that? Then there's the yellow line, which is excess revenue over operating expenses, how much more revenue we're getting over operating expenses.
Yes.
Okay. Then we go through our non-routine expenditures, which I think was the previous slide. And those are the central cost allocation for admin, some property management, CID allocations that we allocate out to all the departments. And so that's taking the whole non-routine expenditures into account. So our total revenue is 356 on just the OHA side. In green, do you see that?
So wait, so those are the non-routine expenses. A lot of these are allocations, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. They're soft allocations that move the money around.
Okay, so that's a different, that's just...
That is, but we book it because we have to book it, so it's in the budget. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay, right.
So you get to where it says the green line, total revenue, and it's at the top of the chart he's trying to show you. It says total revenue, $356,184,000.
Yep.
That's how much money we've got projected to come in.
Yeah.
Our total expenses are $353,445, as you can see. So we're
yes.
Our revenue over expenses is just over $2.7 million that we're projecting that we're going to make, basically, that we'll have for next year.
So
that's the basic budget to operate everything. And then what we do is we pull money from for capital outlays. That's David's list that he went over, that $50 million. So where it says capital outlay, and that was the reduction I'd said from the previous year because we moved it, that's the capital outlay. We do have 1.8 in OPEB and medical benefits, those unfunded liabilities that we have, that we add in, and that actually increases our budget if we add those in to $405 million, but we have MTW reserves to cover those expenses. So
yeah.
HUD-held reserves that we draw down for the development projects that we've been saving. And that's how we balance out the budget. And so we end up with a net reserve. And Vicki or Albert is going to tell me what that's about. Again, it's $182,000. And there's a reason why we're showing a reserve, not a zero.
So that net income number of $182,000 is actually what we have in the non-Fed property. And that's in...
I see. Yeah.
Did you have
non-federal funds. Those are cash flow of non-federal funds, what we're making in non-federal on the OHA side. So it's income that's non-federal, so it's excess revenue that we're not zeroing out with MTW dollars because it's just non-federal funds that are coming into the system. But otherwise, it's basically a net zero budget. We have adequate reserves to cover our development expertise and projects, and that gets added on to the bottom. And we switched this bottom up several years ago just so it made more sense. So you could look at the total revenue in the green line, total expenses on the next one, and see what our real operation is, and then you'll know how much we're pulling out of MTW reserves to fund the different projects in the pipeline.
But now I must be missing something here, because if I look at excess revenue over expenses, and I see that last year it was a negative 3.8 million, call it,
mm-hmm.
And this year it's a positive 2.7. What is driving the reserves?
What is driving? Well, two things are driving. Well, we'll get to the reserves. What is driving? What is driving that difference is an increase in the housing assistance payments that we get from HUD.
Yeah, but with that small amount of excess revenue over expenses, what is creating growth in the reserve account?
Oh, in the HUD held?
If yeah, we, in the reserve
under
account.
Leasing with the Section 8 program. So we have not been leasing at 100%, and that's going to be the final thing we want to throw out and discuss.
Oh, okay.
So if we don't lease up 100% and spend 100% of what we're budgeting, mostly in housing assistance payments because our lease up wasn't there, that money gets held by HUD as a reserve. So it stays there, and we need to figure out what we're going to do with it.
Oh, I see. And this also does not include OPI.
No, not at all.
So that's a whole other ball game.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Right. Now
this is OHA only.
Sense to me. I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I think that's walking through the budget. I don't know what your next slide is. I don't have my thing in front of me.
But could I ask a question?
Oh, that's staffing. Okay.
What are the operating transfers out? That's a big number.
Those are allocations where you're.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's 5210.
Yeah, the operating transfer out, essentially, the way. The way OHA manages money is we have one bank account that distribute funds to the different departments. Not all departments generate revenue. So in order for them to fund the expenses, we transfer money from one department to the cost centers that don't generate revenue. So in accounting terms, we have to show that the transfer out of one department and into another department.
It's a net zero, right. But what happens is, for example, we have two main income departments. We have the Section 8 department, mm-hmm. which gets HAP right. and admin, and we have public housing. So right. they basically pay for everything
yeah.
in those budgets. So there's mm-hmm. a transfer out of Section 8 and public housing into the central office cost center to cover those things. And what Albert was just saying, it's one of the accounting requirements that you show that in your budget. Every move you're making sure. has
yeah.
to be.
And
it doesn't
look,
impact the bottom line
because
it's a net zero. If you're going to charge, you're going to allocate costs for the central office cost center of $15 million, and Section 8 is going to pay for 10, and public housing is going to pay for 5, then in their budget is a transfer out of funds to the central office, but you have to have the transfer in and out shown.
And if you look at the total operating transfer out, there should be a corresponding operating transfer in. And operating transfer in, if you look at the...
Can you refer us to that
The budget
page?
Is 3660000000. So there's an equivalent amount of whatever...
And on the larger sheet, you can see it a lot easier because you can see it by department of what's going in and out. And it's easier to make sense of because you see the whole picture of it.
Okay, I see. Okay.
So the net effect is zero, essentially. Because
yeah.
money is the same.
So if you look at the big sheet, this big one, you can actually see it by department. And if you go down to operating transfers in, you can see how all the different departments who are getting money from the transfers out. You've got central office cost center. I'm going at the last line, for example, operating transfers in. $1.1 million for COCC, security 14, and that's actually security and development, by the way.
Okay.
Family and community partnership, $7 million is a transfer in because they're not making any money. They're MTW are moving it. And capital improvements to our existing facilities and sites is $13 million. And the $13 million you'll see at that last one, the capital improvements, is the $13 million that I was showing you the other change.
Right, from
yep, that was
OP.
Yeah, for OP, yeah, of how we're booking that. So, so the detail on the large one is always, I love it, because I can look and see where things are moving and I understand it. But it is a large and complicated one. The other thing, before I get to my next discussion, it only gets more complicated. I think it took us a lot of years to get to.
Very weird.
We've tried many, many things, but the one thing I just want to say before we get to we have a question to present to the board, and I'm going to make a pitch and see what you guys want to do, and whatever you do, as you know, is absolutely fine with me. But I do want to just point out that in this year's budget, our current revenue and expense lines, if you look at all of us and our two affiliates, our current revenue is $1 billion. $59,000, 59, I'm sorry, 1 billion. I can't even get this high. 059-819-043. We are now over $1 billion mark in what we do for this city and Northern California. And I think that's sort of amazing to me. That is really something. Yeah.
Because it was only a couple of years ago we were saying we're a three-quarter billion.
Yeah, and, well, I'm going to tell you that because I looked this up, that if you go back 10 years, we were around 400.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Boy, your resume is going to look pretty good.
I don't need one anymore. So we do have one conversation we want to have that we do at the end of every budget. And I just handled out the draft, and I don't know if you guys have if you have one on you. Here's a couple extra ones.
Let me just ask one more question,
okay?
Because I'm looking at that very last page of the Housing Authority, including affiliates, okay?
Yes.
So I'm looking at the line total revenue, total expenses, excess revenue over operating expenses is $24 million. Is that what, does that equate to what goes into reserves?
It depends whose reserve. If you're talking about OHA's reserve.
Some reserve.
Then the answer would be yes. That doesn't necessarily account. And it's a great question and good timing because it doesn't really account for what we want to talk about next. These are projected excess revenue over operating expenses of 24, and it can tell you who's generating it, and income and losses if you go across the right.
Yeah, so that.
So for example, you've got CAHI is $7 million of that.
Right. So that is split up between different things.
Yep.
And so some of that 24 million would be retained by OPI.
Yes.
Right.
And OPI and CAHI.
Yeah, OPI and CAHI, that's where all of it would mostly go.
Well, OPI's got 14 million plus.
Yeah, okay, right, yeah. Got it. All right, cool.
So getting to the other one, what we always discuss just briefly, and this is only a draft and we don't want it out there because we have to estimate this because HUD does not give us accurate figures on a regular basis. So we take a look at what they do send us to estimate the amount of HUD-held reserves and also what we have in OHA restricted HUD reserves. So we do have some funds from HUD that were sent to us that we've been waiting for them to reconcile back, but they haven't yet because they just haven't done it. And it is what it is in DC. So I want to walk down the table I just sent off. And again, this is all just, these are estimates to give you an idea of the overall net position of the agency. And we want to discuss maybe one opportunity. So if you have HUD-held reserves, if you look, and then the OHA-held HUD reserves, if you take both of those, it's basically $164 million, which sounds like an astronomical figure until you realize it costs us about $24 million a month to operate. So keep that in mind. And that was last year's budget. In terms of cash and capital outlay, Dave Cadeau talked about what he's doing. We have reserve funds that we've booked against those projects for $37 million. So you see that's the light blue. And then you have outlay for some other projects, which are the renovation of this building and a few other things, and buying some major repairs in public housing that we want to do, some administrative building repairs and renovations. So that's $13 million of those funds that we're holding on to use, including this building. And that gets you a total outlay for the projects of 13. If you combine all of that, you get basically $50 million worth of projects that we have place held those funds for. And I keep in mind that this board cannot approve a resolution authorizing the expenditure of funds we don't have available. So when we go to and we obligate a fund against the Empyrean, which is on the list, you cannot legally do it unless you have the $3 million in a bank or in HUD funds that you can commit to this. So you have to hold these reserves to do development projects, and these are projected out years. So keep that in mind. In terms of our unobligated, the ones that are not going toward these projects, that leaves us with what looks like a lot, which is $114 million. But then we have our operating reserves. You had asked earlier, do we have adequate operating reserves on hand, given particularly the volatile nature of Washington? So we have considered for quite a few years now, and we haven't been disputed when we have had these conversations a couple times with HUD about what we're using our money for. We think 4 months operating reserves is a safe harbor for the conventional program. That's public housing. Mm-hmm. And we think 2 months of HAP expenses are safe harbor. And that means that if they go into sequestration or close down the government, we don't think it's going to last more than 2 months. And so we have those funds available. And if you remember the communications we had around when they closed the government last, we projected we didn't need HUD funds until April, and it was, this is why.
Right, mm-hmm. This is why.
Okay.
And does HUD release these funds pretty quickly when you need them?
They will. We have our own, if you look up a certain percentage of HUD held funds that we're not really supposed to have under the new rule, but we still do until they do the reconciliation. That was saving us during sequestration, by the way. And we got that in December, but right before. And I just think somebody was being really nice. Mm. You know, that
was your Christmas present.
Yeah, exactly. So we weren't. And Victor came in and said, "We just received this on the wire." And we called our financial person, who we know really well in DC. We're like, "What is this?" And she goes, "They'll reconcile it back into HUD. That's clawing it back and not send us housing assistance payments until we expend it." But that's not really taken place. And it may take place in July. We're waiting to see. But there are funds that are available. If we go into sequestration, they will distribute, if you read their notices carefully, as long as you have reserves, they will send those to you in locks. So we can still draw these. And so we just think it's really important. And for an agency this size, what I just explained is $61 million. Mm-hmm. So we need to keep that as a safe harbor of reserves that we have available in the HUD system. So taking all that into account, and knowing that we have operating reserves and some other development, it leaves us with currently an unobligated fund balance of about $53 million. Those are one-time funds is the first thing I want to say about them. We received that additional money were HAP funds that we didn't expend over roughly a 2.5-year period when we weren't at lease up. Mm-hmm. So we were under lease. And they were giving us the HAP, and we weren't able to expend it. In a normal agency, at the year end, they go through year end reconciliation and they take it back.
Right.
As an MTW agency, they don't, and it becomes available for MTW authorized uses.
Wow.
So that's how this all works.
Yeah.
But what we have here is money that we can't put vouchers on the street with, because if we overlease, we're going to go just like our neighbors and be right back. We're going to go into the overleasing scenario because we can't sustain it.
We can't sustain it.
So we have to live within the annual budget. And so what we have been talking about, what we want to kind of pitch tonight, is the board could amend this budget, and we're happy to do it before we bring it back for full approval. And we've talked to Goldfarb about it as well, both Jennifer and Michelle Brewer, about what it would look like if this board wanted to create an affordable housing fund of $40 million, and in the next year, and hopefully relatively sooner, we'd investigate what that looks like. It could look like us doing our traditional loan agreement, but it could also be administered by another party, so we don't have long-term administration of it. Funds can be administered by several different groups in town. I've had a conversation with one of the board members about who knows well, Commissioner Griffith, about how that could be handled in a way that we're not into the deep weeds forever with mm-hmm. these lendings, but they get monitored on our behalf. So they establish an OHA fund and do the monitoring. I think it's a real interesting possibility. I think it's supported. We've talked to the leadership here. I think they support establishing it. It's up to you if you want to do this. And I just wanted to throw it out, get some feedback, and you guys could have a conversation about it. If you do, we'll include it in the final budget that comes back to the board.
Well, I think we
and when does this
from a presentation on that.
I think so.
Understand what the opportunities would be, mm-hmm. what the risks would be, what the limitations would be. Because I think one way of looking at this sheet is that you could interpret this, I think, as we have $53 million of funds potentially at risk.
That's very good.
Were to go wrong, okay? So what you are suggesting is a way to add some level of insurance against $40 million of those funds.
Yes.
Right.
And I don't want to go higher because I think we may have some deals that Dave's talking with that we may come back and use that.
That we need the flexibility.
Yeah. That we might need the $13 million for. So that's why we're thinking around 40.
Yes.
Now, what I'm asking, but let me be clear what I'm asking. I'm not asking, what I'm asking is, do we want in this budget cycle to include the funds as something that's committed toward affordable housing finance? So we're committing it. The board's taking the action. It's not obligated. We haven't issued anything. What we would need to do, because this is a whole new line of business, is come back to the board with a plan and how we're going to do it. And yeah, but we won't do that unless it's in the budget.
Yeah, because, you know, I would like to know why you think this is a really good idea.
And we want to look at available projects, and we want to figure out how much we're actually buying into it. We have been in contact with the city and the mayor's office about existing projects in town. They have a table, which I think is woefully inadequate at trying to tell me what the actual gap is. So I have thrown that back to them saying we need some more, and they realize it. Because everyone's claiming, oh, I have a $32 million gap or a $10 million gap. It's like, no, let's look at your funding and what is the real gap. I did have a conversation with one project that's basically ready to go. They're $1.5 million short of being in the ground. And to me, that's a shame.
Yeah. I see.
And if we can pick those by saying we want to know who's closest to get in the ground, we prioritize, and the least amount of gap funding, we can make that really get some construction started in town. Because everyone's facing what Dave's facing with even the deals and what you've heard with the Empyrean recently, where nothing's cash flowing. The construction went up, the game changed, and there's no one to fill the gap. And if we could play that role, I think we could get a lot of these projects actually under construction. So that's the pitch. There's a lot of planning. It's not going to be overnight. We need to actually come back and propose how we're going to do it and have more internal conversations. We just won't do it unless you guys are really interested in doing it, and we want to put it in the budget as a placeholder so that we have those committed. That's the request.
That's very interesting. I do, like the chair, would like to know a lot more about it. I'm also interested is, are there other ideas for this $40 million other than this?
It is interesting, and that's part of the conversation with the board. And you could choose to have the fund and how you use the fund. You don't have to do everything in 1 year. You know, it's once you do the fund. These are funds we don't want to get a long-term obligation of a family to, because they're not going to be there. It's once they're gone, they're gone. You'll have a lot of folks who come in and they'll say, well, we want to spend, can you spend $10 million helping this number of homeless families this year? Okay, I do that this year. I can't do it next year.
Yeah.
And we have to be really careful about how we engage in programs so we can be consistent and keep people housed. Otherwise, you're going to be ending vouchers on people and you're going to be ending assistance on people. These funds can't be used in a way that is sustaining something that is a real housing assistance, because they're only one time and they're going to go away. They're not something that this agency can sustain. And I would say something else. It sounds like a lot of money for development. It isn't. It just isn't. It, in terms of building this stuff, it will. You could literally do 5 deals with this, and that's how many. But it'd be 5 more projects
but
that are on the ground.
That would be a lot of.
That would be a lot of construction going on that they can't get. They can't get to the finish line.
They're going to pay us back, right?
It goes into soft loans.
It depends.
Soft loans
mean they accrue interest, but they don't pay us during the term. And then if they take us out, they owe us.
How would you actually, how would we make decisions of which project is better?
We would have to do a competitive solicitation, just like the city.
Just like the city.
And then we would make awards from that. And some of the things that we would internally want to look at that we haven't, because this just came about when we were developing the budget, is how do we want to do that? If we want to establish a loan fund with someone who manages loan funds, they may do that for us, although we're the evaluation team and you guys would have to approve them, but they can handle the issuance of that, or we can do it and turn the fund over and they can just manage the fund and the compliance for us. So there's different ways.
And it would be great if we could have a longer discussion about this at our next meeting, just because I know you need to get something into the budget.
Yeah.
And is next meeting enough
The next
time?
Meeting, well, the next meeting we were going to have is the annual meeting in June where we pass the budget. And we could even bring 2 budgets, you know, if you want to have the conversation. But we would want to put it in this year, or we could amend the budget during the course of the year as well. So we could present this budget without it, and then we could come back and as a request to amend the 2020 budget to include an affordable housing fund.
So if we follow this idea and it's done as a loan to projects, it's really a soft loan that you don't expect to see payment back on.
That would be pretty much what I would assume,
Or the housing authority would be behind the traditional lender and the
we
same?
Would. And the other thing that we talked about and with Jennifer and Michelle is that we would keep our current compliance within the funding that we give, the gap funding we already do, because there's already heavier compliance and monitoring from other funding sources. So we would have kind of monitoring light with this amount of money that we're putting into the deals, and that's where I think it becomes really viable to have someone who administers the loan doing whatever compliance, so we're not.
Yeah, I see.
I'd be interested in the criteria that we would put out to decide between projects. I would be interested in how best to use this $40 million so that it, you know, has an impact on our community.
Yeah, I think all those are really important conversations.
Yes, and I think that along the lines of what Lynette was suggesting, mm-hmm. I'm wondering if everyone might agree that we might want to have an agenda item.
I think that's smart. We could easily
of what to address options for this $40 million, and we don't have to call it $40 million. We can just say
affordable loan fund
or reserves or something like that.
Yeah,
and then we can discuss it.
And we can, and there's two ways, and I think from what I'm hearing, this might be the level of comfort for the board if you want to move forward. We can move forward with the budget that we presented and then come back with some more, a deeper view of what this could look like. And then if you wanted to do it, we'd have the resolution establishing, but it would amend this budget to include those funds. And you can do that anytime during the fiscal year. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But I also mentioned two budgets, that you bring back two budgets.
I could. One will have an extra line item at the bottom that they'll add just for this fund.
I mean,
one won't. That's the only difference from the budget perspective, is do you put it on that table or not?
I mean, if it were possible to agree to something with $40 million that wasn't actually a commitment, which we probably can't do, but if we can do that and it's not actually a commitment, then we're not taking a risk. So then I would say, what the heck? You see what I mean?
No, I agree. I don't, and I want to decide whether I think, I don't know.
And
I don't.
And along the
and same. And I don't know if I feel comfortable with you taking the action and making a commitment or not, because the word can get out and people say, oh, you have to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we maybe should just go ahead and then have the larger meeting.
We don't want to make a commitment.
In July. If we want to commit funds for an affordable housing fund, do that at a different discussion meeting. And the resolution will read to amend the 2020 budget to include X number of MTW HUD held reserves for this fund. Yeah.
I mean, like, we could reserve it for doing something good.
Yeah.
And we don't know. We don't know what that
is. Well, and if we get projects for it, that's a whole other thing. And you could decide that you want to do $20 million this year and $20 million next year. You know, there's a lot of variations. And to Commissioner Castillo's point, we can actually target it to projects that we like first, because they have certain level of special needs, like Second Avenue that does homeless seniors for 43 and everybody else.
Yes.
43 units there. So anyway, the other last thing I want to add is the majority of these projects we already participate in, at least through the Section 8 program. So we have a reason that we want to get these things built, because we've already committed Section 8 vouchers to them.
Now, let me throw out one other thing, since it's on the same subject, because you were talking about the $13 million that would be left, right, if we were to do the 40, and when we might need this for development.
Yeah.
Would there be a reason that we could not, I mean, because we put something in the budget, it doesn't obligate us to spend it.
To spend it, no.
So why couldn't we slide $13 million into that budget for something, and then it would move it out of the risk pot?
Well, I'm not
sure. A more secure.
It doesn't move it as far out of the risk pot as you think.
I see. Okay, well then.
Because it's what HUD calls a commitment, not an obligation. Meaning the board has made a commitment, we want to use the funds for this, but they're not under legal contract, so they're not an obligation for the housing authority to pay. And that's been a debate for quite a year. So it doesn't make it as safe as you think.
I see. Yeah. So we can't really define it as an obligation.
And I would also add, I don't see any of these funds at risk during the next fiscal year.
Yeah, okay. All right, good.
Thank you, Director.
Thank you, yes.
Always thinking out the box.
I will. So we'll come back with the same budget that you've been reviewed, and then we'll have we'll put something maybe on July, because we need time to figure this out. It was honestly just a real kind of like, what can we do to help Oakland conversation the past couple weeks? It's not been well vetted by anyone in the room. All right. Is there any other questions for our finance team? I want to thank
all
three of you for doing a great job again this year.
Wow.
I truly appreciate it.
Very fine job.
The numbers, people.
Yes.
Yes.
A very fine job. No, this is really remarkably easy to understand for this level of complexity. Even I can get it.
All right, so we just have a couple more items. We have written communications, which you receive. There's no monthly report because it's early. I did actually have a include something. It's a letter related to CAHI, which says, with a couple of minor details in the end, they're extending the program, the contract, for another 18 months with us.
Good.
And although there is a modest change to the admin fees earned, they're going to add 300 new units, so we're going to actually net or make money.
Good.
So I just wanted that to be, because it was the budget and we just got it.
Yes. Right.
Then we have the rest of the stuff. I did put something on your chair, which is related to a fairly horrible suggestion by the current president about how many families are impacted by eligible non-citizens in our portfolio. Remarkably few. We have 53 eligible non-citizens in just over 30, and it's not on here, just over 30 households. Which is just remarkably few. So we'll watch it. We'll contact those folks directly when we hear what's going on in
those
families.
People.
Yeah.
It's big.
It's big.
It's your life.
But what I found, I did get a call from the East Bay Times today, and I was talking to the reporter, and she said, you know, this is exactly like Santa Clara reported. There just isn't. I was shocked. I thought there would have been maybe
some more. You know how we have such a low Latino family.
Exactly. But in San Antonio, that isn't necessarily true.
San Antonio.
Or, I'm San Jose.
Oh.
But I'm sorry. And they have a very large population in the Southern California Housing Authorities and the Texas Housing Authorities.
Yes.
So he's really hurting Texas, which surprises me, and California, which does not.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's anyway. That's all of my written.
This is just
reports,
for us,
no,
Director? The city of
yes, it's just Oakland. Okay. Yeah, and it was presented. Dominica did that with her staff, and I thought they did a really good job. Kind of hard to read the font, but I guess I'm just getting where I can't read fonts anymore. And that's all I have. So that's written communications and the executive director report. So we're moving on.
Item BIC, I just want to make a note. There are recognition people wishing to address the commission. We have no speaker cards this evening.
No speaker cards. Thank you, Inez. I appreciate it. And now reports by commissioners. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Thank you for taking on the agenda there. And so, reports of commission committees. I don't believe we had any meetings. No meetings. Nothing to report.
Okay.
Other than the fact that we're planning for meetings.
Yeah.
We're getting ready to have meetings.
And then announcements by commissioners?
I have none. Anybody have any announcements?
I have an announcement. Saturday, I know, is an important day for OHA, but it's always on the same day as our Malcolm X Jazz Festival at San Antonio Park, Eastside Arts Alliance, 19th year. So if you're around, the best jazz in town.
Well, that's not far from the house.
David Murray.
Oh, that's cool.
I'm just saying.
What time does it start?
It starts at 12 o'clock and it goes to 6 o'clock.
And what time does our thing start here, the landlord thing?
Huh? In the morning, I think. What time?
8:30,
which means 9.
So just come right after. There you go.
8:30 Saturday morning. No, I might try that.
Did you? I'm sorry. Please forgive me, but there was, you and I had talked about placing a particular conference on our schedule as a point of conversation.
Oh, was it that homeless?
And would you like to speak to that, Commissioner?
Well, I was just wondering if commissioners could use our travel budget to attend other conferences. There's a national national council to end homelessness that's in the summer, although I saw that they're not taking anyone. They're already full. So it
they
might
absolutely
help
can.
Us
no,
to plan for
but
next
we
year.
Might, yeah, you can do one of two things. Keep this in mind. One is when we do the annual travel, we do the list. You can add it to it. But if something comes up during the year that the board wants to attend, then in a board meeting, you just have to do that, make a motion that the board, that it be added to the travel, you guys vote for it, and then we add it to the travel. We used to not do the whole year calendar. It got really confusing for anybody who had to like go through and do it, and it but you can do a motion to add anything during any of the course of the year if you think it's valuable.
So now, could we do that right now?
You could, absolutely.
Conference?
Yes.
Right
yeah.
now?
Yeah. yeah, you just have to name the conference and add it, and I'll put it on the list next
So if you want to make a
right
motion
name.
For it, we can do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I think this is
just
a good
to amend
idea.
That the board approves travel to this conference. That's
yeah.
all it takes.
Yes.
Do you know the actual name of the conference?
I think it's a National Council to End Homelessness, but I need to check. Or
okay.
we could do
yeah.
it at the next.
I mean, you
okay.
can Google it up, just National yeah. Homeless Conference in D.C. It'll pop right
okay.
up.
Does anyone have another announcement real
is
quick?
Is it in D.C.? It's not always
I have another announcement.
Okay.
I want to make sure I send Domenica a flyer about our affordable housing residents advocacy day on June 4th in Sacramento. I want to invite some OHA residents. We have a bus that's leaving from Allen Temple Arms and one that will leave from, I think we're going to go to St. Mary's Center as
well.
I always want to make sure I include our OHA residents. So
okay.
I'll get some information to you. It's June 4th, all day in Sacramento.
Oh, dear.
Very good. So I found the conference. It's the 2019 National Conference to End Homelessness and Capitol Hill Day, July 22nd to the 24th.
That's
so it's in D.C. Is that it?
Yes.
That's and it's by the National Alliance to End Homelessness.
Yeah.
And if you want to make
yeah. Alliance,
and
that's
if you'd like to make a motion
exactly
to add it to
right.
the travel
yes.
schedule, we'd be happy to.
I so move.
There we
I'll
go.
I'll second
it. Move seconded. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? We're authorized.
Great. Thank
to
you.
End homelessness or to try.
Try. Try. It's a big word.
All right. So now that we're finished, we're all finished with announcements, right? So now we go to adjournment. Big item of the night. Pardon?
Please.
Oh, yes, certainly, yes.
Tonight I'd like to ask everyone to adjourn in memory of Gloria Taylor. She was a former commissioner here with the Oakland Housing Authority. She resided in Westwood Gardens before it was now mm-hmm. Mandela Gateway. She passed away in Arkansas. And so some of us remember her as a commissioner here, so I'd like for us to adjourn in her memory. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you. So we technically need a motion now to adjourn, I believe, so that we're all like legal.
Did you want to make that? You made that motion, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
So you need a second?
I second.
Very good. Then everyone have a wonderful evening.
Thank
you all, and thanks.